Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Welcome more to Morris Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Sahaka Amana El-Bay, and today we're dealing with Moore's arrests, affidavits, and court jurisdiction. We want to break this thing down and get up in there and find out exactly what's new and what we can do to solve some of the issues that we have going inside that courtroom. Now, of course, my favorite is the administrative procedure process, but for those who don't know and are already in it, we want to pay attention to what we got going here this evening. Now, we're going to be dealing with the following questions. What is a warrantless arrest? How do we use affidavits in court? How do you represent yourself in court? How do administrative courts operate? What about appearing in court? What is the writ of habeas corpus? Now, these are the things that we're going to attempt to answer here in part one, and hopefully we'll get through the whole thing. We got a ton of information, and let me start off by saying that we are offering our free articles as usual, the 14th Amendment Exposed, the Commerce Game, How to Play, and Secrets of America. And the way to access that is just simply send me an email, say, Tahaka, send me your free articles you mentioned on your broadcast, and I'll shoot that right on to you. Send it to tarhaka53@hotmail.com. That's tahaka53@hotmail.com, and I'll rush that on to you. Also, we have one of the most powerful libraries inside the United States. We have just added a ton of new information. What you're going to hear this evening is already in the archives, okay? And the way to access that is go to tarhaka archives, tahakaarchives.org. That's www.tahakaarchives.org, the most powerful library inside the United States. Okay? Now, I see we have a hand raised. Let me open it up and find out what's going on. Area code 773, are you there?
Yes, sir.
What's on your mind, brother?
Yeah, I was calling your show in regards to court matters. And the thing is that how we deal in court, those are Christian courts. So as a Muslim going into these Christian courts, I always tell people, for one, present yourself as a Muslim of the West and under the protections of the United States Department of Defense File 1-17 under the protection of the National Archive Record Group 147, Book 5-21, File 5-39. And you say, what are these files? Well, these files, they created these files in the 40s for the to separate us from the 14th Amendment citizen or Negro. These was the Morris National Bureau of Vital Statistics file numbers. In fact, I had a brother come to me. He was in the National Guard, about to be sent to Afghanistan. And I told him to record his paperwork in the county, because in Cook County, that's where you register your paperwork. to amend to the advanced estate of the Prophet Nabudu Ali. But the thing is that when he did it, I told him to cite those two classifications to his commander. He did, and when in the process of sending him to Afghanistan, they pulled him out, and he told them that come back in 2 weeks. He came back in 2 weeks. They gave him an honorable discharge, and then they congratulated him for proclaiming his Moorish nationality. Those are military files on Moors, and we're supposed to go in there with our Holy Quran, Circle 7, our 101, which is your affidavit, with our divine constitution and bylaws, which is our divine law. That's why the Prophet on the 1928 nationality card, he said, "I hereby declare you a Muslim under divine law." That's key. And when brothers did that here in Chicago, presented themselves in court as Muslims of the West, the questions were raised and said, what type of immunity do you have? Our immunity relies in document number 1010-5905, book 521, page 579. That is the title of the vast estate. Certified copy of that presented with them with your nationality paperwork files being enlisted as a Muslim, you know what I'm saying, then those Christian courts don't have any claim and title over Muslims. See, the term is really claim and title. Go back to Acts 6. Prophet said, proclaim your nationality. Then he also said, proclaim your free national name. Free national name is a claim. Your nationality is a title. Maybe the title is the free national name, and the claim is dealing with the nationality itself.
So the prophet, let me ask you something. So what you are telling me is that the Moors are supposed to go inside these court rooms and carry Moorish documents and file these Moorish documents inside the United States system of commerce.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Because
okay.
See,
well, brother, I'm gonna have to disagree with that. I appreciate you calling in, though.
Okay,
Moors, let's go ahead and get on down to the subject matter at hand. What we're gonna do here is we're gonna deal with handling yourself inside a courtroom. And what we do, and this is what I do, I don't bring any more of anything inside a European system, because in the first place, to me, that's sacred. And the prophet has said, don't flash your ID for Europeans. So that tells me that not only do I present any identification to him, and which these documents will clearly show that I am a Moor, and these documents belongs to my government, and these are the people that I present these documents to. I have all the documents that I have is with the Moorish American government. I don't put any Moorish documents inside the courtroom. I try to get any European to recognize me at all. I don't need it. But what we're going to do here, let me go ahead on and finish up with what we were doing. Over here on August the 16th and the 18th, we're going to be having the Moorish Summit right here in Jacksonville, Florida, 16th to the 18th. And if you need information about that, just give me a call to Hawker at area code 904-303-9061. The number to dial into the broadcast is 310-982-4184. And what we're going to do here, because there are quite a few people inside the United States who are inside the code, who are having trouble with the codes, and who have not even proclaimed their nationality in the first place. And the way to do that is go straight to register with your government, www.moorishamerican.gov.org. Put your name and your information in there. Put all your family names in there. And register with your census. And there's a national conference call number to dial. And these conference calls are held 7 days a week, Eastern Standard Time. And the number to dial on that is, just hold on 1 second, we get that right to you. that's Moorish American Government. I got it right here. I'm looking in the wrong place. Okay, 760-569-7100. And the access code is 437966 pound. And that is happening 7 days a week, starting at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And there's a period in there where if you got any questions, you can have the floor to open up the floor for you to ask any questions that you may have. But it's as far as the broadcast, what we deal with is we deal with commerce and contract law, and we try to teach the brothers and sisters how to take that man stick and use it on him. And I do not wish to, I mean, I have all the Moorish documents, and I can do a ton of things with them, but I don't want to use those documents to educate anybody other than my people. So what I do is I take his stick and I use that stick on him. And what is sacred is it belongs to my government. Now, we're going to put the information in regards to getting you free articles in the chat room. And the way to access the archives, all that information to be in there. And for those of you who have not gotten hold of the most powerful library in the United States, contact me, Tahaka, at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time after you access those archives, and we'll get in there and work with you and guide you. And everything you need to know about your nationality, everything you need to know about contract law and commerce inside the United States, you can have it right there at your fingertips. Your education, your culture, your ancient story, your etymology. We got tons of law dictionaries in there. Your entire set of Black's Law dictionaries there. Volume 1 through 9. Bloomsbury's there. Bouvier's there. Oxford's there. You name it, is there. Translation from one language to another is there. We just dropped a ton of information in there today. So that's www.talkarchives.org. Okay. Now, first thing we're going to do is deal with something that I found to be very, very interesting in these courts. And it is something that maybe a lot of us is not aware of. And keep in mind, we want to take this man's thing and master it. And at the same time, we want to keep what's sacred and belonging to us. So y'all sit back and hold on for a moment.
Hello. Hello, this is AIB Radio. We're going to talk here tonight a little bit about the foundation of the Quorum Novus and the Quorum Non Juda here. Seems to be some confusion here on these documents. So we're going to sit here, we're going to open up, and we're going to explain a little bit about what these documents are so you can have a better understanding of what this stuff is, how it's supposed to work. We need to go back in, and you need to understand several different things here on these documents. Number one, it goes back in and exposes the entire fraud of the court system. It goes back in and shows how the courts have been operating under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and how they've been given their self-immunity and have been operating in a foreign state capacity against the American citizens in this country. You need to go back and read under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 4J. You also need to go back and read under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 17, of interested party, on who can bring charges against you in that courtroom. These are some of the foundations that you're going to have to go back in and understand. And you're going to have to also understand that we are exposing these judges to a lot of corruption, and we're going back in exposing the embezzlement that the courts are creating against the people. First off, the judge is not supposed to be the one who is sitting down and setting the jurisdiction in these courts. That jurisdiction falls right back into the plaintiff. The accuser, whether it is the prosecutor, whether it is child services, whether it's IRS, whether it's the bank, no matter what the circumstances is, it is supposed to be set by the person who brought you into that courtroom. The quorum nobis and the quorum non juda is strictly a defensive tool. It is for challenging the jurisdiction of these courts. It's not designed to go in and be used as if you are the plaintiff. Go in, because you don't want to go in and sit down and say, well, I'm the plaintiff here, and this court don't have jurisdiction. This is strictly for a defensive move. It's strictly for the defendant to come in and defend himself with within the court system. You're also going to find out that when you start running this, the judge are going to be very intimidated with some of this stuff. They're going to want to go out, and you're going to have your paperwork either the possibility of being dismissed by the court, being frivolous, being stricken from the paperwork, being stricken from the record. Judges are going to do everything they can to get around this, because with this documentation, the judge only has two options with you. And these two options that he's dealing with, either he has to dismiss this thing in your favor, or he's going to sit here and blatantly break the law. But before he dismisses this thing, he's got to get you off subject, got to get you off point. And the quorum nobis and the quorum non juda, there's only two things that you have to do. Two. One is stay on point. No matter what that judge tries to do to get you off, you have to stay on point. And that point is jurisdiction. Like we have discussed in other episodes, jurisdiction is supposed to be set by the accuser. Because there are so many different types of jurisdictions out here, such as admiralty jurisdiction, which everybody has talked about, maritime jurisdiction, administrative jurisdiction, you have federal jurisdiction, you've got state jurisdiction, you've got county jurisdiction, you've got municipal jurisdiction, you've got religious jurisdiction, you've got criminal jurisdiction, you've got civil jurisdiction, you've got family jurisdiction. The list goes on and on and on and on. With each one of these jurisdictions is also a set of laws that's supposed to go with these jurisdictions, so you know what you're doing when you're walking into that courtroom. You can't use a bankruptcy law if you're in here in a traffic case. You can't use corporate law if you're out here on a criminal case. They can't bring in maritime law if you're out here and you're dealing with a divorce. All these different jurisdictions have to be set. All these jurisdictions have to be declared so we know what the rules are when we're walking into these courtrooms. But because they're not setting them, we have discovered that these courts are operating under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. That means the jurisdiction of these courts are operating in a foreign state capacity. Operating in a foreign state capacity means that they have no jurisdiction over the American citizen, because we come under the 11th Amendment. We're not subject to a foreign state. This is what these courts have used throughout the years whenever we have brought charges against our office. They've always screamed, 11th Amendment immunity, 11th Amendment immunity. We can't be sued by a foreign state. We never realized that that foreign state that they was talking about was us when we brought charges against them. Well, this also goes in the other way. If we are a foreign state to them, then that makes them a foreign state to us. That means they cannot bring the American people in and sue the American people on law or equity. They can't bring charges against us. As we've talked about the Corn Novus, this goes back and explains also the different aspects of this, that under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, if they're bringing this in as a corporation, then as that corporation, then they have to give us immunity under this Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. Now, what's the foundation for the corporation? Like we have discussed here in previous episodes, the Style Manual, which was a manual that was created by the Bar Association for Congress and for the courts, that Style Manual is their grammar book. This goes in and redefines the grammar that we've been taught in school. It goes in, if they use all caps, that's what makes you a corporation. This is part of the scam that they're running on American people. We've also discovered under the Delaware Code, under Title 8, under Corporations, under Chapter 6, under 617, how do you name a corporation? Well, a corporation has to have a last name. We've also discovered that in Corporate Trust Company of the Delaware Trust, Wilmington Trust, and Corporate Trust Company of America out of Delaware, that goes back in on March 10th, 1899, where the Esquires, the Bar Association, has went in before the Delaware legislation and has asked them to sit down and create a law, an act providing a general corporate law, which means they wanted the natural person or the corporation to be a natural person. They want the corporation to have all the same rights, all the same privileges. They want the corporation to be registered within the state in the same manner as a natural person. So this is where we come up with how they nailed us. And we're also trying to get our hands on some information prior to March 10, 1899, where the United States Supreme Court had went back and ruled several years prior to this that a corporation is a natural person, that a corporation has to have the ability to be able to buy, to sell, to be able to function within a state as a living, breathing human being. So by setting the stage, by allowing a corporation to take the image of a person, this is how the courts are nailing the American citizens in this country. And this is pretty much going to be probably worldwide if you go back and check that they're also bringing you in your country as a corporation. Foundation of the Corn Novus is that if you go back in and read Black's Law Dictionary, the Corn Novus goes back and explains to the court that, excuse me, there's been an error made. Someone failed to disclose. Somebody withheld information. Now, whether it was done deliberately, whether it was done intentionally, or whether it was done through intimidation and through threat that this information was withheld, goes back in and tells the court that someone failed to disclose information at this hearing that could have set you free, that could have changed the course of this trial. This is what the Corn Novus is. Now, they're going to go back and tell you, some people coming in, well, they repealed this and put it under Rule 4, under Rule Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 60. Thing is, Corn Novus still shows up in Black's Law Dictionary today. It still goes back in. It still has the same purpose and the same meaning. An error has been made. Someone failed to disclose. You're giving this court the opportunity to sit down and correct the record. Now, what we've been dealing with and have found out is some of these courts are dismissing immediately. Some of the judges are challenging the people. People, the foundation of the Corn Novus and the foundation of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act goes back in to what we've discussed back in 1933 under 49 Statute 3097 under Treaty Series 8881 under the Conventions and Duties of the States on December 26, 1933. Congress went in and relinquished the state statutes and turned everything over into international law. On December 9, 1945, under the International Organization Immunities Act, Congress went in and relinquished every single public office over to the UN, bar none. We found this and backed it up with the International Reorganization Rescind Act that a judge filed paperwork into the United States Supreme Court declaring what Congress did in 1945 was unconstitutional. It was not valid because Congress never once brought it up before the people for the people to sit here and agree to this. Supreme Court on October 5, 2005 declined to hear this case. The International Reorganization Rescind Act was never rescinded. It's still intact today. The judge went back and made all the issues to prove that Congress did relinquish all these public offices over. Under Title 8 of the United States Code, 1481, it goes back and explains that whenever you took an oath of office, you had to relinquish your citizenship to this country. Under Title 22 of the United States Code, under Chapter 11, under foreign agents, this is what happens to you whenever you stay here in relinquish. You become a foreign agent. Under Title 22 CFR 92.12 to 92.32, these are the oaths of office. And this thing falls under the foreign relationship, falls back under international law for the oath of office. These are the foundations of what we're dealing with. This is the foundations that we've never supposed to found out about and never dealt with. So this is why when we're walking into these courtrooms and we're filing this kind of paperwork, it is now intimidating the courts because now we're exposing the fraud. We're now exposing the corruption and the misuse of what they're doing to the people. Now, some of these cases we've had people report where the judges have brought in extra security guards to stand behind the people. From what we have discovered, this is where you sit down and make a very simple statement and put it on the record, on the court. Is it your intentions by bringing in these extra armed guards into this courtroom that you are trying to threaten me and intimidate me and that you have trying to cause me to have fear for my life? That by me bringing forth the truth into this courtroom to defend myself properly, you're now intimidating me and you're threatening to kill me in this courtroom by having these armed guards that all you have to do is say, shoot this person down, and they're going to shoot me down in this courtroom because I dare bring the truth in. By making this issue and having it put on record, the judge has just now been put on notice. The people should not have to go to this extreme in order to defend ourselves, but they have pushed us to that point. We have people that are sitting back and complaining. The moment we file the paperwork in, a judge dismisses the paperwork. Don't worry about it. He can't dismiss it because of what we brought up here just a few minutes ago of the 1933 document, the 1945 document, Title 8 of the United States Code, the Title 22 of the United States Code. This judge has to get you off point. This judge has to sit here and try to get you to panic, to get you to back down. This is why with this thing of the quorum nobis and the quorum non juda, you only have two major things to do in that courtroom. That's it, two. One, stay on point. No matter what that judge does to you, you stay on point. No matter what he says, you stay on point. And that point is jurisdiction. Now, this judge has got to sit down and tell you, well, I was appointed by the Supreme Court of this state, and that gives me jurisdiction. It's no, sir, it does not give you jurisdiction. What the Supreme Court did was allow you to be able to sit on this bench through the court system by agreeing that you could be a judge. That doesn't give you jurisdiction. I'll go back and tell you, well, the people elected me. That gives me jurisdiction. No, sir, being elected only gives you a job. And seeing how you made the issue that the people elected you, then what you're telling me is that I can fire you right here, right now, today. You're fired. Because if you're going to make the issue that you were elected by me, then I can fire you. And you're fired. Get off the bench. So don't tell me that being elected gives you jurisdiction. It tells me that you're an employee of mine and I can fire you. If they bring up the issue, well, do you have a driver's license? Do you vote? Do you have marriage license? This, again, does not give you jurisdiction, sir. All this does is sit down and allow me, if I have a driver's license, gives me an address if something happens to me that someone can report to my family. The fact that I have a voter registration card does not give you jurisdiction. It allows me to put people like you in office or take people like you out of office. So don't sit here and fall into the traps and intimidation of these people when they start handing all these excuses. Because number one, it isn't up to the judge to set the jurisdiction. It's up to the accuser. Because if you go back in and start reading the complaint form, whenever you are the plaintiff, it asks you, what jurisdiction are you going to run this thing into? What's the foundation? What is your argument? You have to set the jurisdiction. That now means the accuser has to set the jurisdiction, not the judge. But this is where we've been making our mistakes. We've been allowing this judge way too much power, and this is what the Bar Association has been doing, allowing him to make all these determinations. It has never been by the attorney bringing the charges, because the attorney can't bring the charges because it's hearsay. That's why they can't set jurisdiction, because it's hearsay. This is why the courts are running away with this. This is why we've got to stand fast on what we're doing. That's why there's only two things that you have to do in this courtroom. Stay on point and stay on jurisdiction, and don't let them get you off jurisdiction. Now, this judge may sit here and say, well, let's get by this here a little bit. We've got some other issues. Says, no, sir, until jurisdiction is set by the accuser, you cannot move any further. This falls back under the Code of Civil Procedure under Chapter 5, under Rule 418.10. You have personal jurisdiction. You have personal persona in that courtroom. Until the proper venue and jurisdiction is set, that court can't move. And now that we know that they're operating under foreign sovereign immunity, that court cannot proceed under foreign sovereign immunity. And they will never admit this. People are panicking because judges aren't following the rules. They're going to try to sit down and sidestep this every which way they can. That's why you have to stand fast, stay calm, and argue this. Like I said, the judges are going to do one of two things here. He's either going to dismiss this, or he's blatantly going to break the law. There's only two choices he has. Now, we have developed several different things for paperwork, what we're coming up with. One of the issues that we are dealing with is the allocation of jurisdiction. And this is where, in the documents, of where the other side has to set jurisdiction. It's a requirement. They have to set it. They never do. And this is the foundation. This is what your objection to. I object. The other side has never sit down and declared jurisdiction. Stay on point. They've got 10 days to sit down to do this issue, and don't allow them to get off of it. Don't allow them to sidestep this thing. That's one of the first documents that you want to put in if you're going in for the first time. But you're also going to file in the quorum nobis. Like I said, that quorum nobis goes in and explains that there's been an error made. With this quorum nobis, you're going to file in also the following documents. You're going to file in the Coram Nobis Terrorist Act with your Coram Nobis. What this document does, it goes in and it makes the issue that it has come to my attention that all federal, congressional, and state legislative enactments, rules, regulations, or anything created by private corporations or associations, agencies, instrumentals, or entities that are defined under the judiciary and judicial procedure of Title 28, Section 3002, is being deemed by many administrators in this field as anti-government patriot laws. If anything that we have filed in has been declared patriot laws, they have deemed us to be militia, constitutionalists. They have deemed us to be KKK, neo-Nazis. Ladies and gentlemen, we aren't the ones that created all these codes, rules, regulations. All this stuff was either created by our elected officials, Congress, on the state side or the federal side, or it has been created by corporations that Congress made privately to go back in and create the rules, regulations, and guidelines. This is what they are deeming to be anti-government patriot law. So we're going to shove it right back on them. But we're also going to go back and make the issue under the H.R. 1955, which is the Homegrown Terrorist Act, and H.R. 3162, which is the Patriot Act, under Section 800. Section 800 goes into domestic terrorism. And under domestic terrorism, it sits here and goes into quite a bit of detail and quite lengthy of what is domestic terrorism. That by that judge or administrative officer, rather, by him bringing in armed guards into that courtroom, he has just now committed an act of terrorism against an American citizen. He has now made an aggressive move against you to intimidate you, to coerce you, to threaten you, to blackmail you, to intimidate you. If you don't agree with this man sitting on the bench, he's going to order these people to shoot you down in that courtroom. And that's exactly the mentality you need to run with when you're dealing with these people, because that's exactly what they're doing. The other thing that we have developed, you're going to fall in with this, is also the non-slave owner. This goes back in to September of 1850. We have discovered on September 18th, 1850, that this law was repealed. This goes back in for slave ownership. This is where the registration stuff comes in at. Are you registering your car, putting your deed up for your home, voter registrations, birth certificates, all this comes out of the Slave Act that was repealed in 1850. What they're doing, they're bringing you in as a slave owner. This is where that straw man deal comes in. This is your slave. You have to go back in and make the issue that I'm not a slave owner. These are the documents that you're going to put in. So you're going to put in the allocution of jurisdiction for your first hearing, that the accuser never made the issue of what jurisdiction. The quorum nobis you're going to put in. You're going to put in the Quorum Nobis Terrorist Act and the Quorum Nobis Non-Slave Owner. And we have a entry of judgment that we can file with this in order to have the judge dismiss this because the accuser has failed to state jurisdiction on your case. Now, this Quorum Nobis can be put in also if you've already had your hearing, you've already been convicted. I'll go back in and file this back in along with the Terrorist Act, along with non-slave owner, along with the entry of judgment to go back in and have the record corrected. The quorum non juda, if these first documents fail, the quorum non juda is going back in and now point blank telling the court, I put the quorum nobis in to tell you that an error was made. You refuse to acknowledge this. Now, the quorum non juda, now I'm telling you, you're not a judge. You have no authority and you have no jurisdiction, and your order is void. This falls back under Rule 60 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Now you're point-blank telling the judge they don't have. You gave him the opportunity to go back in and correct the record. He had every chance to sit down and do his job right, and he didn't do it. Now, with the quorum non juda, we've got several documents for it. You have the quorum non juda objection. This is where you start filing this in, and the objection goes into congressional records. You're now telling the court why they don't have that jurisdiction, because you're going back and explaining to them in 1933, under this 49 statute, under 3097, under Treaty Series 881, under Conventions and Duties of the State, that Congress relinquished all state statutes to put everything under international law. You point blank tell them, this is what, these are congressional records. This is what Congress did. This is why you don't have jurisdiction. This is why you don't have subject matter. That's why you don't have venue. That's why you're not a judge. That's why you don't have the authority, because Congress took it off of you. Also falls back under the International Organization Immunities Act of December 9th, 1945. You put this in also as evidence. Put it in as an exhibit or evidence, however you want to call it. Now you're going back and telling the court that 1945, Congress relinquished your office and made this office under UN. You are no longer an American citizen. You now are a UN employee. You're also going to put in that International Reorganization Rescind Act, where the judge sat down and filed paperwork in and shows that the Rescind Act was never rescinded. Supreme Court declined to hear this case, but this goes back in and explains where this judge has blatantly, point-blank showed where Congress violated their constitutional position by relinquishing every single public office in all these states over to the UN for their total jurisdiction, for their total control. We're also going to file in with this document, Title 8, 1481, where they gave up their nationality. They gave up their citizenship the moment they took that oath of office. You're also going to go ahead and put in that Title 22, that CFR, under foreign agent. The accusers are now going to have to come back in and rebuttal this. They're going to have to come back in and make the issue, and they're going to have to prove that Congress never did any of this, and these statutes don't exist.
Okay, Morris. Now, we just dealt with jurisdiction. We're going to come back with Rod Class. These guys have done a tremendous amount of work in exposing a lot of things, and we're taking it down, and we're using this information to succeed in the courts against Europeans without educating them to our stuff, okay? And by the time we use that, when we use that kind of information, we will come at them as a nation, opposed to as an individual. And I want to also add, once again, that when it comes to contracts, you have to understand the United States operates under contract. And if you can just keep in mind that any time you receive a contract, you should deal with that contract immediately. If it's a summons to come to court, you can go ahead on and write, cancel that contract right there on the spot, and follow the little three-day rule, put it back in the envelope that came in, put it in another envelope, and address it back to the court, and get it right back to them ASAP, letting them know that you are canceling, you're refusing the contract. And the same thing with when you get a traffic ticket. Don't set the traffic ticket down and walk away, and then later on down the road pick it up and then try to figure out what you do with it. No, the same three-day rule. You cancel that ticket and write no contract. I refuse to contract with your court. I'm opting out your court system, any invitations to your court, and I do the same thing with that, and I get it to the county clerk's office. And so if we can do master these things, these are things that I want you to learn, opposed to just getting some documents and filing it somewhere and somebody patting you on the back and say, oh, yeah, you're more. We don't need that. What we want to do is we want to master the rules of the game. So at any point in time, anybody comes up, we will not only have the documentation, but we will have the knowledge, which is power. And this is something that we can have and use all the time, opposed to just having something that you can file somewhere and forget about it and then go back to living your life. And then when it come times to dealing with another issue, you got to go get another document from somewhere. No, we deal with the actual power of gaining the knowledge and having this knowledge, so it's automatic and natural, and we just use it regardless of what circumstances come up on a regular basis, on a daily basis. When you're dealing with your debt collectors, when you're dealing with your mortgage companies, and I must say this past year I've had quite a bit of fun, especially with the mortgage companies. It is amazing how we were able to stay on top of them and the banks and do to them what they have been doing to us for years and years and years. And so that's why it's so important to have a power base in your home where you can have what you need at your fingertips. A man should be able to, if he's got a problem out in the street, he should be able to walk straight to the house, push the phone to the side, crank out what he need on his computer, and file that lawsuit immediately right off the top of his head because he has the knowledge and the power. And I know what I'm talking about because I have done it. And I have had people contact me and say, well, look, man, we're going to fly you here. Can you come to our state? I go there, spend a couple of days, boom, done, done deal. And this is the kind of power that we want to exercise without educating anybody to what is sacred to us, okay? Now, we're going to, like I said, we're going to be coming back to Rod class, but we're going to go down and get into another portion of this broadcast. If you got any questions or comments, go ahead and raise your hand. And the chat room is wide open. For those of you who want to call into the broadcast, you dial in 310-982-4184 and follow the props on your phone and we'll recognize your hand. Okay? All right, let's roll.
And we're going to discuss today how to be your own lawyer, how to go to court, how to write paperwork that you can go into court and prosecute your case with. So I'm going to show how to create court documents and the procedures to follow in preparing for court. I mean, I'm extremely amateur at this, but, you know, I've got some experience. And so what I'm going to tell you is that it doesn't take a whole lot of studying and learning to be able to do this. It's not impossible. And if we're going to hold anybody accountable for their actions, my feeling is unless you can take them to court and make them defend themselves, they don't care if you complain about things. Most of us never go to court and would consider it somewhat more dreaded than going to the dentist. It is true that an element of satanic worship is present in the court system today as they are taken over by greedy people bent on lining their pockets with the fruit of our labor. But because of necessity, I feel the need to venture forth in this arena. The beginning of the process starts with a controversy. I mean, if you're not having an argument with somebody, there's no reason going. Two people have to disagree about something, and the administrative process will begin. In the administrative phase, one party sends another party a demand for payment of some sort of property that they believe they have a right to. And that could be, you know, getting prosecuted for a crime, violating a public policy today. I have never seen government agents or banking-related institutions ever send factual, verified proof of the alleged debt. They just make the demand. I have a whole show on administrative remedy, and if you have not watched it, now is the time to do so, as it is a very important part of the battle, in that it sets the foundation for later. Every action you take will have the purpose of gaining court admissible evidence. All courts recognize the importance of administrative procedure in that it helps remove controversies that need to be adjudicated from being presented and wasting the court's precious time. If one party is in dishonor and refuse to participate in the administrative process, they are denied the right to cry about it later and are looked down upon by the court for acting in dishonor. This is noted in the maxim of law that states, quote, "He who slumbers on his rights loses them," and, quote, "failure to deny is to admit," and the concept of acquiescence and latches. And here's from Black's Law the definition of acquiescence. Acquiescence and latches are cognate but not equivalent terms. The former is a submission to or resting satisfied with an existing state of things. In other words, if you don't complain about it, you have acquiesced to it. While latches implies a neglect to do that which the party ought to do for his own benefit or protection. In other words, latches gets counted when you fail to respond or a period of time has gone by and you haven't done anything to protect your rights. Hence, latches may be evidence of acquiescence. Latches imports a merely passive assent, while acquiescence implies active assent. In re Wilbur's Estate 334 PA 45, 5A 2nd 325 331. Quote, acquiescence relates to an inaction during performance of an act, while latches relates to delay after the act is done. Bay Newfoundland Company versus Wilson and Company 24 DEL period chapter 34 A 2nd 668, 671, 673. Quote, acquiescence is a species of estoppel. Quote, Bankers Trust Company versus Rude, 211 Iowa, 289, 233 Northwest, 794, 802, 73, 8 period, L period, R period. And this is from Black's Law, 4th edition, printed in 1968, page 40. Let's move on to the court procedure. If you are being sued and have gotten a notice or summons to appear, the clock is ticking, and your time will run out on your opportunity to defend your rights, and you will lose by default if you, quote, fail to deny, and slumber on your rights by not putting a response into the court record in writing. First thing to do is to go down to the clerk of the court, whether it be criminal, the criminal side or civil side, depending on the suit against you, and ask for a true copy of the complaint if it's civil. If it's criminal, then the traffic ticket or a warrant for your arrest, although they may have not arrested you yet and just had you sign a promise to appear. Once you have received the complaint, you must file an answer or you will have lost your right to challenge it and receive a default judgment. So let's go into the timeline of what's going on to unfold in a court battle and try to acquire a simple understanding of what's going on. The beginning of all lawsuits starts with a complaint. So what is a complaint? The complaint is a signed declaration by the plaintiff. The plaintiff is the one that's prosecuting or suing, who is the one making the claim that an injury or loss has occurred, describes the injury or loss, and it has to be personal. They have to have suffered the loss, presents facts that support the claim, and presents law, case law and codes, statutes, or some other form of regulation that shows when the facts presented are proven to be true, damages are due to the plaintiff for being injured either physically or through a loss by a breach of contract. Unless you are fairly wealthy and lazy, you will not be well represented by an attorney in the document writing stage of the lawsuit, as no attorney will be able to properly prepare a case against their own masters. Because, let's face it, who sues you? You know, how many suits in court today are, you know, your gardener's taking you to court because you didn't honor the contract? 99% of the suits are either the government is assessing a damage, a charge against you for violating public policy, another word for crime, right? You violated the penal code or the civil code or whatever. Or it's the bankers who, through credit card or mortgage or some kind of debt, are taking you to court. Your neighbor's hardly ever taking you to court. Which are, if you are defending against the government, would be the ones who granted the attorney his privilege of making a living through the license to practice law. And if it's the bankers, then he will know that they are the true self-appointed owners of the courts. If you go to trial, then an attorney may be able to do much better, a better job of examining and cross-examining witnesses, as the judge and opposing counsel will be merciless with their objections to deny you getting evidence to the jury through testimony. You can hire an attorney if you can find one willing to help you, but only if you hire one, only on the condition that they are co-counsel, which is like having a joint bank account where both signatures are required. If they contract to help you as co-counsel, then you have the right to deny their actions in court. Without the co-counsel status, they have the right to speak against your wishes. I mean, if you sign an agreement to represent you, then even if you don't want them to do something, they have the legal right to do it because of that contract. You are considered incapable of speaking in court and a ward of the court once you get an attorney. No one can know your case better than you. Some can present your case better than you, but most likely the court will not allow them to be your constitutionally allowed counsel. I mean, if you got somebody like me who's a legal scholar to speak on your behalf, the court will immediately challenge you as not being a licensed attorney, and therefore you cannot represent someone else. Because the courts are private, for-profit businesses that only give token lip service to be in public places. Can a policeman tell you to put away your cell phone if you're on the street, or tell you you can't nap on the park bench? To get into a position to enforce your rights, you will need to first answer their suit and then file a counterclaim to become the plaintiff in your own complaint against them, because at this point they will be trespassing on your rights unless they have a lawful claim. The plaintiff always wins, the defendant always loses. I always write up a common law court of record counterclaim and note all the defects in their suit against me and claim they are committing fraud and have no jurisdiction. That's the big one right there. And as many other things as I can find as possible. As I indicated previously, the first thing to do is to send in a conditional acceptance and make your claims, noting no jurisdiction, no corpus delicti, or no standing, no factual evidence supporting a claim upon which relief can be granted, because if they don't have any evidence, factual evidence in their claim, then they haven't produced anything. No license to practice law in evidence, no power of attorney to represent the plaintiff, because they never show you the contract they have with the plaintiff, do they? So how do they have a right to represent them? No evidence of a, quote, real party of interest under Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 17A, etc. Have this sent by a notary, proof of service. In other words, you get the notary to sign a proof of service and send it on your behalf, and get an affidavit of non-response and send them a notice of default if they do not respond to this administrative procedure. So let's look at an actual counterclaim. Okay, here's an actual counterclaim example. In the upper left corner is the name of the presenter of the document. So up here it would be the attorney's name, or if you're presenting this document for your case, it'd be your name, your address, and your address is going to be, if you want to be on the private side, you're going to be non-commercial. So no, ND is non-domestic, and you can put your zip in there, but your zip is going to have to be in a box, because anything in a box is not visible to the court. So the attorney will show their name, their bar card number, address, because you have the right to and requirement to send them your documents, right? If you're going to do an opposition or an answer or anything else that you're going to present into court, it's going to have to be sent to the other party. So the other party is required to put their name in, usually a telephone number, but it's not a requirement, so I don't put mine, and the title and the status of the presenter. So in this case, this person would be presenting it, if it's you, as pro per or in your proper persona. And then let me read in proper persona here, and that's straight out of Black's Law. In proper persona is one's own proper person. It is a rule in pleading that pleas to the jurisdiction of the court must be pled in propria persona, because if pleaded by an attorney, they admit the jurisdiction. As an attorney is an officer of the court, and he is presumed to plead after having obtained leave, which admits the jurisdiction. Laws P191. Black's Law, 4th, page 1968, page 900. Is the caption wherein the name of the court is noted and the plaintiff is noted. So we're going to look at this. Here's the caption at the top where it says the Superior Court, State of California, County of Alameda. And this whole area is the caption, right? Everything above this line. So this is the original, this would be, if you were just plaintiff versus defendant, this box up here would be there. And it identifies the plaintiff, and it identifies the defendant, and over here it has the case number. And if you were making a pleading, the pleading would be over here. So it'd be like a complaint or an opposition to a motion or whatever. Then you start in with the body of the writing. Anything below this line would be the body of the writing. So in this case, it would be contempt of court, bench warrant. And then you would go on to start making your summary, basically, is what's going on here. And the case number is noted. The title of the document is noted, like motion to dismiss. That would be the title of the document, along with any exhibits or attachments. So you would put exhibits 1-10 or however you want to name them. Then you start in with the body of the writing. Whatever is said in the body of the writing is what controls the paper if there is a conflict between the caption and the body. So it's kind of like when you write on your check and you spell out $1,100. When you spell out $1,100, that's what rules, as opposed to writing in a dollar sign with a 1100.00, which is $1,100, right?
Okay, Moses, we back. Now, what is being described is basic format for a basic affidavit. And when dealing with these courts, you want to make sure that you use the affidavits. All of these segments on this broadcast are in the archives in video format, so you can actually see them. However, the information was so important, I thought I'd bring it here so that we can get a gist of how to deal with these people when we're filing these cases inside and outside of the court, even though the focus is on dealing with them in the court, and we're going to get down into the crux of that this evening. However, what you're listening to now is a basic description of an affidavit, or whatever you type of affidavit that you're going to use. The title is place, notice to agent is notice to principal is notice to agent, basic format. And when you whatever city or state, whatever state that you are in, even though I have many different types of affidavit templates inside my archives, it behooves us to find out what is basically being used in the state in which you are in. And if you find out or look at a sample copy of that in the match, which you already have, just go ahead and use that. And I don't see very much difference, but you want to make sure that they don't have any excuse for saying that something is wrong about anything if you are following the guidelines and rules and regulations in order to beat them with their stick. You see what I'm saying? One more time. We often have free articles for those of you who just tuned into the broadcast. The way you access that is simply hit me up at the talk of 53@hotmail.com. We are offering the 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game and How to Play, and Secrets of America. Just send me an email to tahaka53@hotmail.com, and I'll rush that on to you. Just say, Tahaka, send me them free articles you mentioned on your broadcast, and we get it on to you. Okay, let's continue with this segment here.
Here we have the UCC 3-402, signature by representative. So when you sign as authorized representative of the all caps name under I, if the form of the signature shows unambiguously, that means very clearly, that the signature is made on behalf of the represented person who is identified in the instrument. You notice how sometimes under the line that the signature on, it'll be like so-and-so law firm, and then the person above will be the attorney, or it'll be the attorney's name in all caps. Well, that's unambiguously, right? Because that's showing the signature is the all capital letter name that's listed below it. Or it could be Bank of America underneath the signature line. And the signature on top would be who's representing Bank of America. So if you say, you know, as authorized representative, then that's unambiguously. The representative is not liable on the instrument. You have no liability if you sign as the authorized representative. Let's look at the criminal timeline here. The first thing that happens is the arrest or the ticket. And in the arrest, you go before the judge for a probable cause hearing, and with the ticket, you sign a promise to appear. If you sign the promise to appear, you're giving jurisdiction up, and you're entering into a contract. And then the next thing is you have time for administrative remedy. This is where you're sending in conditional acceptances or refused for cause. If you send the DA a conditional acceptance of the charges against you, then if they don't prove the claim, then you send a default estoppel and you get everything file stamped and you have something to go to court. The next thing is get a copy of the docket showing who the players are and when the complaint was filed. These would be more in criminal, not in traffic, because traffic, they don't have a docket that shows when everything is filed. But in a criminal case, you know, a misdemeanor or a felony, you'd get a copy of the docket that shows who the players are, who's the judge, who's the DA, and what was stated at the hearing, and it'll show when the complaint was filed. And you want to get a copy of the complaint. And then we go to a file is created and a complaint or ticket is filed. First hearing is the arraignment. At the arraignment, the purposes of the arraignment is one, to identify the defendant. I mean, you have to stand up and say you're the defendant. And if you don't do that, then the court has a problem. Two, they have to read the charges because you have to, under the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution, the United States Constitution, you have to know the nature and charge. And they consider reading nature and cause. And they consider reading the charges giving you the nature and cause, but that's not actually true. Three, they have to decide on who will speak for the defendant. In other words, if you're going to get a lawyer, then the lawyer is going to speak for the defendant, and if you're not going to get a lawyer, then you have to sign something that authorizes you, the living soul, to speak on behalf of the defendant, and you're not the defendant. Four, ask for a plea to the charges. The judge is going to ask for a plea. Now, in order to plea, you have to have a legitimate charging instrument, and you have to have injured somebody. And so, under the penal code, they can plea for the defendant if the defendant refuses to enter a plea. So you're going to bring a script to court and read off the script, and it's like a chess game. There's four things they're going to have to do, and you're going to know that they're going to have to do them. So you're going to get ready for them and challenge them on that. You can also bring your conditional acceptance and challenge the fact that they have a lawful case. And the last thing we're going to look at is writing motions in the statutory world. So you can write a motion to dismiss due to invalid charging instrument or no injured party or a number of other reasons. A misnomer, which is the wrong name, lack of subject matter and personam jurisdiction. A motion to disqualify the judge, the DA, etc. And then you can, in the common law, you can write writs like a writ of error, a writ of quo warranto, which challenges their authority, and a writ of prohibition, which means that unless they can prove that they have jurisdiction, you're going to remove the case to a higher court. And since they don't actually have a higher court high enough to hear your case, I guess that'll just mean that it goes in limbo. And here we are with the civil timeline, in case you're in a civil trial. First, you got a summons that the suit is filed and the date for a hearing is set. And you're going to, after you get the summons, you're going to go to the clerk of the civil court and get a copy of the complaint. Because if you don't know what the complaint is, then there's no way you can put a motion to dismiss or an answer to the complaint. The next thing that is going to happen is that you're going to have a chance to do administrative remedy. It should have been done prior to this because, you know, if you're going to have a civil complaint against you, a civil complaint is a complaint for money. So the credit card company is asking you for money, or you're in a foreclosure situation, or somebody is asking you for money. And so administrative remedy would be, you know, accepting the fact that you owe money based upon proof of claim that they have suffered a loss and that they actually lent you any money. So your administrative remedy should have been done prior to this point, but if it hasn't, you can start it at this point because usually a court case is going to take longer than 30 days to complete, and 30 days is enough time to get an administrative remedy completed. And then you're going to file a motion to dismiss or an answer using your administrative remedy or a motion to strike or something, some way of not having to answer this or filing an answer. And if you don't file a motion to dismiss or a motion to strike or an answer within the 30 days, or in some cases within 5 days, in an unlawful detainer case, it's only 5 days, if you don't file the answer, it's a default judgment and you lose. It's just a summary proceeding after you go to court and the judge will say you're guilty and you owe the money because you didn't file an answer or you didn't file a motion to dismiss. And, you know, you're going to use your administrative remedy if it's done, or you're going to cite that there's no standing to sue on their part, or file in a common law, or file a writ of quo warranto or a writ of prohibition for lack of jurisdiction. And then you're going to go to the next phase would be after you're engaging and you're saying that you don't believe that you're liable, you're going to issue a subpoena to, say, the CFO of the bank or to someone else to testify and bring the original wet ink signed contracts and accounting documents. Affidavits of a loss, send a demand to see the attorney's license to practice law, a power of attorney to represent the bank, show attorney's bonds or insurance policies, and a demand for discovery. Demand for discovery, they're going to have to show you what they have, what they're going to use in court against you. And everything they send you, they can use, but anything they don't send you, they can't use. A subpoena, a deposition from the bank asking for proof of loss, possession of the original contract, etc. They can't enter any hearsay evidence. So in other words, somebody has to testify that he knows that you have injured them and that they have suffered a loss. And you'll be surprised how many people are unwilling to make statements of that sort, because once you prove that they're lying, they can go to jail for that. And then the other thing you can do is file a counterclaim for lack of jurisdiction and fraud, denying your right to liberty, as you now have to defend a malicious prosecution. Okay, here we have a motion to dismiss, and up in the left corner we have the party who's sending it, John Doe, and their address and their position is authorized representative and pro per, or you could be private attorney. And then the court, this is the caption area, the court it's in, and then here we have what it is. It's a motion to dismiss with the exhibits JD1 through JD5. And then we go down to the motion to dismiss, and we start off, comes now John Doe, sui juris, one of the people of California in this court of record, to motion the court to dismiss the matter, and then you name the matter number or the case number for failure to state a case upon which relief can be granted. And then under the footnotes, under the people in one, the footnote down here says, at the revolution, the sovereignty devolved on the people, and they are truly the sovereigns of the country, but they are sovereigns without subjects, with none to govern but themselves. And then sovereignty itself is, of course, not subject to law, for it is the author and source of law. But in our system, while sovereign powers are delegated to the agencies of government, sovereignty itself remains with the people. So what I've done there is I'm saying I'm one of the people, I'm sovereign. And then in this court of record, and there's a footnote too, a court of record is a judicial tribunal having attributes and exercising functions independently of the person of the magistrate designated generally to hold it and proceeding according to the course of common law, its acts and proceedings being enrolled for perpetual memorial. So then we go over to the next page where we're going to list out the facts. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to state the facts and that are going to support our claim. 1. On or about May 30th, 2009, I, John Doe, was served with a summons to appear in Superior Court of California, County of Alameda, to answer to the complaint in matter number. So I've described what happened there. That's true, so that's unlikely they're going to lie about that. They're going to admit it. Although they wouldn't know whether you were served with a summons or not. 2. The complaint contains no facts supporting a claim of injury or loss. Oftentimes, their claim against you doesn't actually include any facts. What would a fact be supporting the claim? How about a copy of the original contract and then the fact, you know, the statements showing that you didn't make the payments, which would be, at least be some facts, but they don't even include those generally. You know, in an unlawful detainer, they never show the fact that they actually paid the bank and got a, you know, they don't show the canceled check. So where's the evidence that they purchased the property? All they have is a piece of paper from their county recorder's office showing that they're the new owner. That doesn't prove anything. 3. The complaint does not show the plaintiff suffered an injury or loss under the required element of standing. And then footnote 3, standing. The requirement of standing, however, has a core component derived directly from the Constitution. A plaintiff must allege personal injury fairly traceable to the defendant's allegedly unlawful conduct and likely to be redressed by the requested relief. Standing has a core constitutional component that a plaintiff must allege personal injury fairly traceable to the conduct. There has to be a personal injury or a loss. And Doe is challenging jurisdiction in this motion to dismiss, and no jurisdiction has been shown to exist by the plaintiff. I'm putting that in as a fact because it's true. I am challenging jurisdiction. 5. Doe sent the CFO, care of Capital One Bank, South Dakota, a debt validation letter dated February 16th. This is the administrative remedy that had been done prior, and received by UPS certified mail number on February 22nd. So I have evidence that through certified mail that they received the debt validation letter, and I sent it to the CFO. I didn't know the name of the CFO, so I just said CFO, care of. 6. Doe did not receive any rebuttal to his debt validation letter dated February 16, 2009. And then I have a footnote 4. And then at footnote 4 it says see exhibit. Down at the bottom here, it would say see exhibit JD2, which would be my notice of default. 7. Doe sent a notice of default estoppel to Capital One Bank. And then we go down to 2, law of the case. Now this is where I'm going to declare the law of the case. And it states, I, John Doe, decree the law of the case as follows. Now, the sovereign decrees the laws, so since I've stated that I'm one of the people and I'm sovereign, I'm decreeing the law of the case. 1. All case law and codes, etc., noted in the footnotes. These are going to be the law of the case. Anything that I put in the footnotes to support my case is going to be law of the case. 2. To claim a debt, a party has to have a lawful debt owed to it, evidenced by a lawful contract. And footnote 6, debt, a sum of money due by certain and expressed agreement. And this is out of Black's Law 4th, down here. And then the definition of money in Black's Law, fourth. It is usual and ordinary acceptation. It means gold, silver, or paper money used as a circulating medium of exchange and does not embrace notes, bonds, evidences of debt, or other personal or real estate. So money means gold or silver, or paper money that represents gold and silver that can be exchanged for gold and silver, but not notes. Now, your Federal Reserve note is a note. So then we go back up to three. The elements of a lawful contract are the meeting of the minds. Valid lawful consideration must be exchanged. C, two or more wedding signatures under full commercial liability. So I'm stating that these things are the law of the case. I'm claiming that in order for a contract to be valid and lawful, it has to have these things. But it's not just me that's claiming them, because I'm citing references. Set four, the plaintiff suing must prove jurisdiction by demonstrating standing. Five, money is not credit. Six, all items mentioned in California Evidence Code sections 451 and 452, among which is included the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And then I go to two, conclusions of law. The plaintiff, Capital One, N.A., South Dakota, has filed a frivolous suit without merit, without facts supporting a claim of injury or loss, and does so after being lawfully estopped from making any claims against the defendant. That's our administrative remedy. One can only conclude that the plaintiff moves forward committing a fraud upon the court. Capital One has made the claim that the defendant received money from them, yet under the legal definition of money, they have not shown any factual or verified evidence, in other words, a sworn affidavit, of any lawful consideration was given to the defendant. In conclusion, the plaintiff and its attorneys, Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe, have not presented a claim upon which relief can be granted. I, John Doe, pray the just and honorable court dismiss this matter, and then I name the case number, and award me damages as the court deems proper. And then I sign it without prejudice, by colon, and then the signature as authorized representative of John Doe / pro per. And that's a motion to dismiss. Simple. And here we have a another court paperwork writing to enter. And this is a disqualification of judge, disqualification of DA for cause, comma, disqualification of DA for cause, per CCP 170.1, which is a Code of Civil Procedure and the California Constitution and government codes, verified, and then the exhibits. So, disqualification of judge for cause. I, John Henry Doe, sui juris, one of the people of California in this court of record, do decree Judge Virginia Danner is disqualified to act as a judicial officer, magistrate, for the following. One, for failing to meet the California constitutional requirements of having a lawful oath of office filed within the time allotted and having vacated her office. Two, now I got a copy of her oath and it doesn't comply with Title 20, Section 3 of the California Constitution, which I include, and it shows the codes that show that she's vacated her office by failing to file within the 30 days. Two, for failing to present a valid bond as required by the various government codes and codes of civil procedure. And three, for not being an elected judge per CCP 170.1. In the Constitution, if you don't consent to being heard by a judge that hasn't been elected, you can disqualify them for cause. And I do not stipulate to representing myself, a living soul, before any judicial officer who has not been elected. Four, for having a financial interest in the defendant. Five, for not providing a certified copy of Danner's required bond per government code. Six, Danner has showed her lack of impartiality by representing the prosecutor in a hearing on June 30th, 2010, when John Henry Doe was requested to cease acting as counsel for Jane Doe unless he could prove he had a California state-issued license to practice law per Danner. John Henry Doe demanded that Andrew Luss, deputy DA, produce his state license to remove himself from court per Danner's requirement, to which Danner stated no, which is an expressed intention to legally represent the prosecutor. So in which case, if the judge is going to represent the prosecution, that's a conflict of interest. 7, for failing to timely answer the writ of quo warranto, and on and on. So you see, you can enter a disqualification of the judge or the DA, and that would be one way to do it. And here is how to do a simple conditional acceptance. You would take the presentment, which is a demand for payment, and in this case it's from the Franchise Tax Board of the state of California. And this is a demand for payment, court-ordered debt collections. And I simply took a red pen and wrote on top of it, I, John Doe, conditionally accept this presentment based upon proof of claim that I am liable. Failure to show proof of claim within 10 calendar days after receiving this will stipulate to abandonment of claim. And then I signed it without prejudice by colon my signature as authorized representative of the all cap letter name, who it was addressed to, and dated it. And if I send this off proof of service, certified mail, and they don't respond within 10 days, and I don't receive a response with them from 10 days, then I'm going to send a notice of estoppel against them. Default. You defaulted and you abandoned the claim. Thank you very much. The other thing that you should do in this case would be, you look up who are the people in charge of the Franchise Tax Board. So John Chang and Betty Yee and so-and-so. You would send it to one of them personally, to John Chang, care of the Franchise Tax Board.
Okay, Morris, we're back. And so as you can see, to me, I don't know, maybe some of you just tuning in for the first time or just being exposed to this, it's basically pretty much simple. The rules and regulations, there's ins and outs of every situation, and you can do it like you want once you master the rules of the game. Area code 314. Are you there? 314.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Tell us who you are, where you're calling from, and what's your question?
I'm calling from St. Louis, Missouri. I had a question about filing like a counterclaim suit for child support. They tried to sue me and put me on probation, and I was trying to file a claim in the district court to sue them for violating my civil rights. But I went through the process, and I missed a few steps, and I was wondering how do I go about doing it the right way the second time around.
Okay. Well, usually you're getting presentments in the mail. Is that correct? And now,
I get coupons in the mail from the child support.
Uh-huh.
People pay them.
Oh. Okay, and they have somebody that's sending you these coupons. Well, what I do, because to me, it's fun. You understand? A lot of people don't understand me saying that, but what I do is I get the one that's sending it first, and I put him up under the bus, and then I find out who his boss is, and then I go get them. That's long before we even get to a court. See, the administrative process is what you want to use prior to going to court, and all that information is in my archives and all the documents that you use, letters, examples, and all of that. But dealing with the situation, that's what you want to do basically. You want to take they're trying to put the fire up under you. So what you have to do is turn it around and put it up under them. Please provide proof of claim. If you're claiming that I owe you money, who? You're talking about a corporation or a man? I mean, you understand what I'm saying? You can mix it up and send it to them, because see, you discover they're good at sending stuff out, but they're not good at responding to when the fire come back in their house, you see. And just like the guy just said, he take the presentment, he put them up under the gun, and he give them 10 days to respond. You say, I owe you money. Okay, give me a proof of claim. And you got 10 days to bring it. 10 days go by, then you send a notice of default and estoppel in the story. Okay, now, once you send that, you got ammunition, the date, they don't do nothing. All right, so when they come to you talking about going to court, you count the court date up. You want to go in there and blow them up in there, however you want to do it. Whichever way you want to have fun. It's up to you. But it's just a thing of master rules of the game. You have to turn the get rid of the fear factor, because what they're doing is they call themselves trying to keep the pressure on. You see, they got all kind of mechanism. They come up behind your car, cut the lights on, woo woo woo. All this right here is designed to throw you into a mode of fear and uncertainty. And you can't talk straight. You scared. You don't know if you're going to jail and all this other business. You see, but what you have to do is take a few of these pigeons and fry them. And once you do that, right there, then you discover that a whole lot of stuff will be going around, but it'll go around you.
What do I find these archives? How do I get to these archives?
Okay, you just go to www.tahakaarchives.org, right there online. As a matter of fact, I'll put it on in the chat room again, and just the link there, just go there, and as soon as you get that done, then you call me, and I'll walk you through and show you exactly what to do with them.
Can you spell that for me? How you spell that? T-A what?
T-A-R-H-A-K-A. That's Tahaka, T-A-R-H-A-K-A. And then the word archives, ARCHIVES, and that's .org, TahakaArchives.org, one word.
Okay.
You got another question?
Yes, sir. Another question I had, I had a lawyer on that case or whatever the case may be, and they gave me...
Well, you have my condolences.
Thank you for that. $3,000.
Okay, good. And so he took you, how long was the ride that he took you on?
It was last year when this happened to me. See, I just came into the knowing of trying to fight these people, so I'm kind of new at this.
Okay.
So,
all right, so you hired a lawyer. What did he do?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
What did the lawyer do?
Not a damn thing.
Okay. all right. Well, then he was doing his job. him and the judge are both members of the bar. They be at the golf club together.
Mm-hmm.
So you went and got the judge's best friend and both of them your enemy.
Right.
All
right.
That's how that go. I be trying to get brothers and sisters to understand what's going on, man. I mean, I be hearing horror stories all over the country. How lawyers be there took people $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, and then I had one brother. He jumped on a lawyer in the courtroom. Oh. Man, it's mad, man. Y'all gotta learn this stuff, man. And so I decided, I'm going to teach my people how to do this here. And you don't need no lawyer. And then if the judge, he don't like it, then we got something for him.
Right.
Too.
It was last year or whatever. And then, like I told him, he's trying to give me 5 years probation for $3,000 of child support felony. Man, I ain't take that. So he played for me anyway. And I told him, don't do it. But they gave me 5 years probation. So... I went around. I turned around and filed a suit in the district court, and they dismissed my claims for being frivolous and moot.
All you had to do is appeal that. Anytime they throw stuff out, appeal it. Going up to the high court.
And then I appealed it, and then it went to the appeal court. Then they denied me a rehearing, and then I tried to send a citizenry up to the Supreme Court, but I missed the timeline on that, so that's why I said I wanted to go back through the process and exhaust all my remedies and start back over to get them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll start with the administrative process, and I get that lawyer too.
Yeah, I'm getting him too. Most definitely getting him. So that's why I asked that question. And I had another question. I had tried to file for child custody, and I went to the civil court, and filled out a form of papyrus form, and the court clerk that worked there, or the employee, or the court clerk assistant, whoever she was, she said when I filled it out and I was zero, which, you know, I was filing as a poor person, she told me the judge was going to take that. And I said, how you know the judge not going to take it? You haven't even presented it to her. So she took it back there to her, and she denied it anyway. And then she told me to read it. And I just looked at the paper. I said, well, what's this? She said she denied it. So I said, well, give me the paper. So she snatched the paper and ran downstairs. And I was looking for them. I asked for a grievance form. You know, they tell me, we don't have them. So she's talking about, you got to pay the filing fee. I said, well, I ain't paying a damn thing. And I walked out.
Okay. All right, brother. Okay. Well, you just give me a call and go over there to Hugger Archive, and we'll get all this straightened out.
Okay.
All right. Appreciate you calling in.
No doubt.
All right, Moses. We back. We're winding up. The time is winding down here, and we're going to go on into the next segment. Please pay very, very close attention. And for those of you who don't have these archives, I'll put it in the chat room for you so you can access it, and then we can help you out. Okay? So y'all sit tight.
And make the issue, and they're going to have to prove that Congress never did any of this, and these statutes don't exist. They can't. This is why these judges are trying to dismiss this thing as being frivolous. That judge cannot dismiss this on his own. The other side had to file paperwork, had to go back in and make the issue that Congress never did any of this. The accusers never file paperwork in. Never file paperwork in. It's always the judge that's making the decision here without any documentation from the other side. You object. I refuse this paperwork because the accusers were required to rebuttal the facts put before this court. They have to prove that Congress did not relinquish the state laws and turn them into international law, and that Congress did not relinquish your office and turn you into a UN employee, and that Title 8 doesn't mean that you didn't give up your citizenship, and Title 22 means that you aren't a foreign agent. They cannot rebuttal this because it's the facts. Congress created this stuff. But along with this, you're also going to put in the definition, the quorum non juris definition. In this definition, it goes back in and defines what a person is under federal statutes as well as state statutes. Now, you have to use the corresponding laws for your state that deals with the word person. But also, you have to go back in and look up the corporation aspect for your state. And you also have to go back in and look up the political subdivision terminology. This is pretty much standard all through the federal guidelines, what's in this documentation. But you have to fit it for your state. Now, the accuser is going to have to go back in and justify and prove that when they brought you into that courtroom, they didn't bring you in as a corporation. They're going to have to make this argument. Here again, this judge cannot sit here and say, well, this is frivolous. I'm going to strike this. Sir, you can't strike anything, and sir, you can't say anything that's frivolous because the other side never sat down, filed any paperwork in to sit down and rebut any of this. You're making law from the bench. You're making decisions from the bench. You're now in violation of Title 18, Title 28, 454 and 455, violation of federal laws. I object. You can't make this distinction. The accuser has to sit down and file paperwork to rebut all of this, and they never filed one document in. Because they have never filed, they have remained silent. That means that my paperwork stands on its own as being valid because the other side never disputed it. You can't to protect them. You're now in violation of your job. We also went in and we created the reversal. This way you go back in, and you now can go back in and file this in and have that decision reversed. To give that judge the opportunity to get his head out of his butt, to do his job right. We also have the defaults, 1 and 2. We also have it where it has to go to the clerk of court under Rule 55. A judge cannot make determination on default. It has to go back in to the clerk of courts. The clerk of courts is the only one that can set defaults up, not the judge. We're giving this judge way too much abilities here and too much maneuvering room. We need to put him on a short leash, how we sit down and how we deal with him. It's up to you, the people. How far do you want to push this thing? So like I said, there's only two things that you have to do in this courtroom. Stay on point, stay on jurisdiction. Now, whenever you're running the quorum nobis or the quorum non juda, you cannot file any motions into the court. You can't file anything in that's going to give the court jurisdiction to make a decision. The quorum nobis and the quorum non juda plainly tells that judge he has no jurisdiction. Only thing that he can do is dismiss the case for lack of subject matter and jurisdiction. That's all he can do. That's all the room that you're leaving him. You're not allowing him to come back in and do any frivolous. You're not allowing him any other room to come back in and make any other decision other than to dismiss this for lack of jurisdiction. The moment you file a motion for oath of office or you go file a motion to ask all these other questions, you're now giving the court jurisdiction to answer you instead of dismissing your case. Don't go in and start asking questions. The biggest problems that we have with running this paperwork is, number one, the people don't understand the paperwork. That's why we're making this recording. Don't understand what quorum nobis is. You don't understand what this whole paperwork does. You need to sit down and read the documents. You need to understand what the documents are. They're not that hard. Second, get rid of your ego that you're smarter than they are and you're going to try to trap them and you want to get them to confess their sins before you sit down and drop the hammer on them. When you start trying to get these courts to sit down and start bringing them out on a flypaper, so to speak, or you're trying to get them to confess their sins and bring them in for repentance, 9 times out of 10, you're going to trap yourself, because when you're doing this, you're giving court jurisdiction and they're going to come back and hammer your butt. You got off the point. Point is, stay on point. Stay on jurisdiction. Don't get off into these other little realms because you want to try to trick the court into doing something. These courts have been around for over 200 years. They know how to deal with you. They know how to manipulate you. They know how to get you off the subject point. And when you're trying to get them to come onto a piece of flypaper so you can sit here and trap them, you just got off point and you gave that court subject matter, you give it jurisdiction. Because you didn't do your part by holding firm on jurisdiction. You give it to them instead of keeping it off of them. But we have created a whole section of documentation on questions and answers from the Department of State. What is a foreign state? Who falls under foreign state? I've also developed a cheat sheet for you to sit down to be able to walk in and stay on point. Stay on subject matter. Stay on the jurisdiction of being able to back up your arguments. We also have you got to go back and read Rule 4. I gave you a step-for-step procedure under Foreign Sovereign Immunity. How to file this paperwork in. When to file it in. This thing isn't this hard. People, we are normally our own worst enemy in these courtrooms. We do more harm to ourselves than they do to us. All they do is see that weakness and they feed it, and we keep hammering ourselves on this stuff. It is up to us to sit down and start taking these courts back. And we're trying to do this through peaceful means. We're trying to do this through paperwork. We're giving these people an opportunity to correct the record, to get their head out of their butt on what they're doing. It's up to us on how we sit down and run this paperwork. Paperwork is some of the best paperwork out. You've got all the evidence to back this thing up. You have the congressional records. You've got the rules. You've got the regulations. You've got the statutes. All you're doing is defending the truth in this courtroom. Let the other side rebuttal what Congress did. They can't. That's the whole issue here. That's what this whole foundation is on. It's all based on the truth, all based on facts, all based on documentation. The other side cannot go back in and rebuttal that Congress did not create 49 Statute 3097, Treaty Series 8881, Conventions and Duties of the State. The other side can't rebuttal this. It's in the history books. It's in Library of Congress. The other side cannot rebuttal the International Organization Immunities Act of December 9, 1945, that Congress relinquished their office over to the UN. They can't rebuttal this. The other side cannot rebuttal Title 8, 1481, of them giving up their citizenship. People, you are walking into this courtroom with the facts, the truth, in your hands. All you have to do is defend the facts and defend the truth. Stay on point. These are the facts. These are the issues. These are the laws. Now, this other side, the accuser, has to rebut this. They have to prove that Congress never did this. And if they can't, then this court don't have jurisdiction. It can't have jurisdiction. Because here's the fact that you are no longer an American citizen. Here's the fact that this office now comes under UN. That's how simple this argument is, people. Don't complicate this. Don't try to clutter this thing up with all kinds of other crap on any of this. Right now, we're sitting here and we're trying to do a recording. Guest one, you're more than welcome to listen in. We're talking about the Quorum Novus and Quorum Non Juda. I'm doing a foundation on what this stuff is, why it exists, and what we're doing with it. People, we have the facts on our side. We got the proof on our side that these public offices don't exist legitimately. We have the proof that Congress relinquished all this stuff over to the UN. We have the proof that Congress relinquished all these state statutes to international law. We have the proof that these people don't hold public office. The courts are going to fight you tooth and nail on this. They're not going to come down and sit here and shake your hand and sit here and say, oh my God, thank you for revealing the truth to us. As we're exposing over 200 years of corruption, we're going back in and we're exposing the amount of federal funding fraud. We're exposing the fact that they stole your home based on fraud. They stole your children based on fraud. This is not going to go down easy with these people. And if you think it is for 1 minute, you better think real hard about this, because this isn't going to go down easy. These people are being caught in a lie. They're being caught in a scam. Now, we're trying to do other paperwork of bringing in the IRS into this. IRS is going to be one of our best friends. IRS is going to sit down and be able to help us by bringing in a W-9 form into your hearing and ask this judge and the prosecutor to fill out a W-9 form or a 1099 OID or a 1099 CAP or a miscellaneous or an A, B, C. There are different 1099 forms that need to be filled out. And tell the courts, you're going to operate, then fill out these forms for taxes, because we're not going to allow you to embezzle any more money. We're going to report it to the IRS. Now fill out the paperwork. And if you're bringing me in as a corporation, then where's my dividends? People, we have avenues to go run with. But for you to sit back and throw your hands up in the air the moment this judge sits here and writes your paperwork off as being frivolous, and you panic, there's no reason for you to sit here and panic when you get the truth in your hands. There's no reason for you to sit here and panic whenever you have the evidence. They don't want this stuff on record. We didn't create this problem, people. They did. It's quorum nobis and quorum non juda. It's real simple, simple paperwork. All you have to do is go back in and understand the foundation, because all the information is being given out to you. As we get new information, it's being added to it. You have the truth on your side. You have the truth, the facts, the laws, congressional records that backs up your statement. Courts cannot disprove any of this. The accusers cannot disprove any of this. It's up to you what you want to do with it. It's up to you or whether you're going to stand on the truth and push it or allow them to intimidate you and threaten you. And the moment the judge sits down and sends some paperwork out and says, well, this has been stricken from the record, you immediately go back in and do an objection. You sit down and tell this judge, you have no authority to do anything.
Okay, Morris, keep in mind that everything that we're listening to this evening is lined up along with everything else that you need in Tahaka's archives. And you all hold on 1 second. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come in and slide on down toward the end of this broadcast.
Oh,
So that's what controls. I like the presentation to be very concise and with as few pages as possible. In other words, if you're going to put a complaint in, a complaint that's 6 or 7 pages is going to be more likely to be read than a complaint that's 50 pages long. I mean, who wants to read? You should be able to make your case without spending a lot of time with paperwork. You know, generally you have 15 pages to get your complaint noted. So if it's longer than 15 pages, you don't have to have an excuse. The judge will have an excuse not to read it, as it is conventionally considered the maximum length. I think arranging it to have a summary at the beginning that gives an extremely short Reader's Digest description of what you are trying to accomplish. Next, you will have to present the facts that support your claim, where all the facts, and this will include absolutely no opinion of yours or conclusions of yours or hearsay evidence, etc., just facts. So on this date, the bank sent me a letter, and the title of the letter and the date of the letter and whatever, right? You have to identify things, but it's facts. It's a fact. And your position is that if I can prove these facts, then the law should apply to me. No hearsay evidence, because you're going to have somebody testify to the facts being true, right? It's your testimony, if you're going to put some facts in that somebody else is going to testify to, then you're going to name the person who's going to testify and put them in as facts. So people or papers you have in your possession, you can subpoena. People or papers to be presented in court. Next, I want to have my court, and it is my court because I present the evidence to support my right to claim my court in my opening statement in the summary. The first challenge is a challenge to jurisdiction. So what's the challenge? Now let's go back and look at the opening statement here, right? Comes now the Constitutional Court and finds Jose Guillen and Gary Byron in contempt of the authority of the Constitutional Court for violations of its orders in writing and in the presence of the Constitutional Court on January 5th, 2010. And then we have a footnote here. What's the Constitutional Court? We go down to the footnote. California Constitution, Article 6, Section 1. The judicial power of this state is vested in the Supreme Court, Courts of Appeal, Superior Courts, and Municipal Courts, all of which are courts of record. So I'm pointing out that the Constitutional Courts are a court of record. I'm a court of record. And then, in addition, the legal definition from Black's Law 4th, revised in 1968, is, quote, court, the person and the suit of the sovereign. So I've already demonstrated in previous writings that I have claimed that I'm one of the people, and as the people are the sovereigns of the state, then I'm a sovereign. The place where the sovereign sojourns with his regal retinue, wherever that may be. So if I go to court, it's still my court while I'm there. Now we're going to read the definition of jurisdiction from Black's Law. And that is, it is the power conferred by the Constitution or by law. And when they say law, they mean common law. Corby versus Dooley, 313 Illinois Appellate, 509, 40, N. E. 2nd, 581, 584. And that's from Black's Law 4th, page 991. And then I'm going to read you another definition of court from Black's Law. An agency of the sovereign created by it directly or indirectly under its authority. So if I'm sovereign and I create my own court, consisting of one or more officers, hey, I can be the only officer of the court, established and maintained for the purpose of hearing and determining issues of law. Now, let's read that again. Law, every time they say law, it's common law, so issues of common law. In fact, regarding legal rights and alleging violations thereof, and of applying the sanctions of the law authorized to exercise its powers in the course of law at times and places previously determined by lawful authority. So I determine when the time and place is. And that's Ispel versus Stovall, Texas Civil Appellate Court, 92 Southwest 2nd, 1067 and 1070. Those are the pages. And this is from Black's Law, 4th edition, 1968, page 425. We go on to jurisdiction is control, right? The definition of if I have jurisdiction over you, I have control over you. And if I have control over you, then basically you're my slave, right? Because it's a master-slave relationship. So since slavery's been abolished, there is no way that jurisdiction can be an element that is constantly in force against me. Nobody can have jurisdiction over me all the time. So jurisdiction's control is the right to forcibly make someone answer to a controversy. If the King of France comes to this country and gets a speeding ticket, does any court in this country have jurisdiction to force the king to come and answer to the charges? We all know this is not true. That's why we have to send extradition orders to other countries to get them to come, to get them to force one of their subjects to come over here. No, the rules are made for the subjects that are duty-bound to obey the rules, those rules, and not for others. If a citizen of Mexico steals property from someone in the United States, can't the Mexican consulate have him extradited back to Mexico because the U.S. has no jurisdiction over Mexico's subjects? The two countries, or sovereigns, and they like countries like to consider themselves sovereign when actually they're not, can dispute the control over the man, and so can I. As one of the people, what a definition of one of the people would be, sorry, quote, at the revolution the sovereignty devolved on the people. Sovereignty devolved on the people. And they are truly the sovereigns of the country, but they are sovereigns without subjects, with none to govern but themselves. And this is from a Supreme Court decision, Chisholm versus Georgia, U.S. Doodall, 419, 454, and that's from 1793. Being sovereign, dispute the control that a legal fiction, i.e. the state or the bank, in other words, the plaintiff in your case, have over me. Are they not foreign to me as we are dissimilar entities? I mean, they're legal fictions, dead entities, and I'm a living soul. It's when the state or bank claims that they have jurisdiction because you have an address in the state, that is false because it assumes they have control all the time. If they have jurisdiction or control all the time, then you are a slave because you cannot be free and under the jurisdiction all the time, or there is a master-slave relationship. So I believe jurisdiction is acquired rather than constant. It is acquired when you have violated the common law by trespassing on your neighbor. This is best shown in a Supreme Court decision from 1905. I'm going to read this decision. It's Hale versus Henkel. The quote, the individual may stand upon his constitutional rights as a citizen. He is entitled to carry on his private business in his own way. His power to contract is unlimited. He owes no such duty to the state, since he receives nothing therefrom beyond the protection of his life and property. That's the purpose of the state. His rights are such as existed by the law of the land, long antecedent to the organization of the state. So what law existed prior to the organization of the state? Common law. And can only be taken from him by due process of law. That means in a court. And in accordance with the Constitution. Among his rights are a refusal to incriminate himself and the immunity of himself and his property from arrest or seizure except under a warrant of the law. He owes nothing to the public. You don't owe your neighbor anything. He owes nothing to the public so long as he does not trespass upon their rights. Hale versus Henkel, 201 U.S. 43 in 1905. The acquisition of jurisdiction in a common law trespass where your neighbor has hit someone, as this is a trespass upon the man's personal property. What's his personal property? His body is his property. In statutory acts, it is expressed as corpus delicti. So let's see a few examples of case law describing this. Mark Stevens' website has a long list of corpus delicti case law listed for each state. in every criminal trial, the prosecution must prove the corpus delicti, or the body of the crime itself, i.e. the fact of injury, loss, or harm, and the existence of a criminal agency as its cause. You have to have criminal intent, okay? And what's an injury, loss, or harm? If you were, like, drunk in public and you're being charged with that as a crime under the penal code, then is there an injury, loss, or harm? Now, we notice it says in every criminal trial, right? So a misdemeanor charge or a felony charge is a criminal trial. If you're being charged in a criminal trial, there has to be the fact of injury, loss, or harm. And this is a California case, People versus Sapp, California from 2003. And this is quoting from People versus Alvarez, a 2002 case, 27 Cal 4th, 1161, 1168 through 1169, 119 Cal Reporter 2nd. So if you have a criminal case, then there has to be a fact of injury, loss, or harm presented and some facts supporting that claim that there's been an injury to be proven, or there's no jurisdiction or right to proceed with a trial, as there is no claim upon which relief can be granted that has been presented. The real question is who, and I mean a man or a woman, is claiming that you injured them. I mean, you never have a claim against you by one of the people. Now, the California Code states that all writs and suits shall be processed in the name of the people. Well, that's fine. You can process it in the name of the people, but you better have a person who's a witness to come and testify. In other words, if your neighbor sees you hit another man over the head with a baseball bat, he doesn't have to know your name. All he has to do is tell the policeman, I saw that guy hit that man over the head with a baseball bat. And they'll take you in and arrest you for that. And when you go to court, they don't have to have your name. All you have to have is that person as a witness. That witness's testimony becomes the charge. So, have they presented any facts that a person has been injured and that an injury has occurred? In addition to this challenge to jurisdiction, you can find all sorts of violations of their own codes to include as defects in their case, making their accusations false and fraudulent in that they fail to answer your administrative presentment, claiming they don't have these things, since without having these things, they had knowledge and they were proceeding against you anyway, knowledge that you had complained about it. After failing to provide proof of claim or to show cause why they, the DA, had the right to proceed, or the bank had the right to proceed. If it's a civil case where the bank or credit card is suing you for a breach of contract, then the jurisdiction is acquired when they can present facts that support their claim that they have suffered a loss due to your actions. This is expressed as no party has the right to sue unless they can show standing. And here are some standing cases from Mark Stevens' website. So, it says, over the years, our cases have established that the irreducible constitutional minimum of standing, notice it says constitution, that's U.S. Constitution, minimum of standing contains three elements. First, the plaintiff must have suffered an injury in fact, an invasion of a legally protected interest, which is concrete and particularized, quote, actual or imminent, not conjectural or hypothetical. Of course, it has all these court case sites to support that. Second, there must be a causal connection between the injury and the conduct complained of. The injury has to be fairly traceable to the challenged action of the defendant and not the result of the independent action of some third party not before the court. Third, it must be likely as opposed to merely speculative that the injury will be redressed by a favorable decision. And this is from Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife 504 U.S. 555 from 1992. quote, standing represents a jurisdictional requirement which remains open to review at all stages of the litigation. And that's the National Organization for Women Incorporated versus Scheidler, 510 U.S. 249, 1994. And that is also a United States Supreme Court decision. So when the bank sues you, do they have jurisdiction by having the constitutionally required element of standing, by showing a concrete injury or loss? Do they ever present any actual facts that they suffered a loss by your not paying them? Nope. What they do is try to show that you signed a contract with them and that you didn't live up to the contract. There's a difference between saying that you didn't pay them and saying that you suffered a loss. Now, you'll have to do a lot of studying to see the difference, but, you know, it's there, trust me. You'll have to watch the show on foreclosure and other money-related shows to understand that the banks do not loan anyone money. And the definition of money in Black's Law? Money. In usual and ordinary acceptation, it means gold, silver, or paper money used as circulating medium of exchange and does not embrace notes, bonds, evidences of debt, or other personal or real estate. Lane versus Rayleigh, 280 Kentucky, 319, 133 Southwest 2nd, 74, 79.81. And that's from Black's Law, 4th edition, page 1157. Now you'll notice it says does not embrace notes. Now take out your Federal Reserve notes in your pocket and look at it, and it says right at the top that's a note. So when he's talking about paper money circulating as a medium of exchange, he's talking about fiduciary money, which can be exchanged for gold or silver. I mean, if you want to give somebody, in 1913 when the Federal Reserve first started, when they gave a $20 bill out, it said redeemable in gold to the bearer at any bank. So you could go to a bank and give them a $20 piece of paper and they would give you an ounce of gold. So they do not loan anyone money. They only loan credit, which can be, they create on computer screens from thin air, and your promise to pay or promissory notes is what funds that credit and or credit applications. So how could anyone show evidence that they suffered a loss if a man or woman did not send their labor exchanged for bank deposits of pieces of paper to them? They suffered no loss and cannot prove they did, so they have no standing to sue. This is why if you challenge the jurisdiction on the order of in a crime, corpus delicti, or in a civil case, standing, they don't have any standing. Therefore, and they haven't presented any evidence that they have standing. Therefore, they have no jurisdiction over you as they have never presented any factual evidence to support their claim. We all understand the common law view on money and debt. Money is exchanged for items one wants if the seller agrees to the exchange. Anything we receive for our labor as having value is usually in the form of a paycheck or a private check from the employer. This piece of paper is a negotiable instrument and can be allegedly redeemed at the bank for cash or what we accept as money, i.e. Federal Reserve notes. Actually, we never can redeem them for money, as only gold and silver or some valuable commodity like a can of beans or a piece of furniture has actual intrinsic value, and the bank will never give you those things. The piece of paper has no intrinsic value, and its replacement cost is about a penny. Can we ever get gold or silver in exchange for a Federal Reserve note? No. What we can do, and the only reason we accept the Federal Reserve notes or checks from others for our labor, is that they can be exchanged at the grocery store or the lumber store, etc., for something of real value. What happens when they refuse to accept Federal Reserve notes at the lumber store or the grocery store? Then what? Their true value will be the heat burning them can produce. The real question is, what would life look at without the bankers creating the credit in the form of checks or Federal Reserve notes? How much would a house cost if the bank could not do home loans? How much would a car cost if the bank could not do car loans? If everyone who loaned money actually had to save it up from their own labor, loans would be few to people other than family members. The prices would plummet and the slavery would cease to exist. when you bought a home or a car, it would be yours, and the state could not lay claim to it as they do now, because we don't pay in gold and silver, which is common law money. We can't claim ownership as we paid with debt instruments, and the straw man franchisee, government employee, all one, is the named tenant on the property. That straw man is the tenant. This allows the state to treat us like renters and take the property if we don't pay taxes. You can't tax private property under the Constitution. Private property is a right, not a privilege. So why not make the bankers prove they operated according to the law and not outside of it? Are they in truth outlaws? If they don't recover the money they print from thin air, I won't shed a tear for them. If they break the law, shouldn't we hold them accountable? If they want to work and labor for the money they loan, then they deserve to have it repaid to them or take some form of collateral like a car or home, but not otherwise. Next, although as one of the people and sovereign, I am not subject to legislated law, only common law, and those who are employees of the government or get their authority to operate through licenses from the government are bound by its legislative acts, stated as codes, statutes, ordinances, etc., and therefore I can introduce the codes, etc., as evidence if they have violated them, and they violate their own public policy all the time. I mean, if you're a worker at Walmart, don't you have to obey Walmart's policy? So if you're a worker for the government, don't you have to obey the government's policy? If I'm not a worker for the government, why do I have to obey their policy? Next, I will have my court take judicial notice of whatever I want to include to be the law of the case. Since I'm a sovereign, I can declare what laws I'm going to use because the sovereign makes the law. And the sovereign decrees the law as long as it does not injure another and only protects my property and rights. I show it as a sort of contract in this case only. The government does exactly the same thing in its lawsuits against you, and unless you challenge their authority to decree the law, you will lose. This is the very meaning of sovereignty, is that the decree of the sovereign makes law. American Banana Company versus United Fruit Company. And that's a U.S. Supreme Court, 213 U.S. 347. Then I will present the conclusions of law or memorandum of law. In this part, I can draw conclusions based upon the facts I have presented and the case law or codes, etc., the law of the case that I've decreed, that have been alleged to have been violated, and pray for a judgment in my favor. Sign it, seal it, and then if I have already been sued, I can simply mail it off with a copy of the proof of service to the opposing side, and then show the original wet ink signed proof of service along with the wet ink signed counterclaim to the clerk of the court and enter it into the record, and also get my copy. Well, I'm going to bring two copies. Well, there's going to always be three copies. One gets mailed off to the opposition, the opposing lawyers, the opposing bank, or the DA. One gets mailed or presented to them first, and you get proof of that presentment, and then you go to the clerk of the court with two copies. One copy gets entered into the court's records for its file, and the other copy is your evidence, and you get them to stamp your evidence. Now you've got evidence. You've got a file stamp copy proving that you put something into the record. Okay, here's an example of a pleading that was entered by allegedly Capital One Bank, who is the plaintiff, and then this is the defendant. And then here's this is the caption area. This is what the complaint is about, and in this case, you know, they cite the case number, and then they put it's a complaint for money. Breach of written contract, money had and received, and amount stated, and then they checked off. Amount demanded does not exceed $10,000. And you see up in this corner is the name of the party who's presenting it. So we'll just look and see, and we'll show you that that is done by an attorney, right? And then this is the court that it's entered into. It don't even have the court name capitalized, which is very unusual because it's always in capital letters. And you can see that this is what they're asking, right? This is what this document is going to be. It's a complaint for money. Now, if you had it, if it was your answer, then the word answer would be over there. Or if it's an opposition to the motion to strike or whatever you're submitting, that's what you're going to put. In a counterclaim, it would be trespass and trespass on the case. And then you'd have your exhibits or whatever. Here's your caption. And then below the caption, you'll see, comes now the plaintiff, Capital One Bank, N.A., hereinafter plaintiff for all causes of action against the named defendants, so-and-so, hereafter defendants, and each of them, in other words, they're suing John Doe's 1 through 10, and each other defendant sued as a Doe defendant. So anyway, what I'm going to point out to you is one easy way to deal with filing an answer to things like this is to just make a photocopy of the same paperwork they presented, only this time you're going to take some white pieces of paper and place them over the things that you don't want to come up. Right. And now, when you make a scanned copy of this, everything will be the same, except up here, you're going to just take your pen and write in your name, John Doe, and your address. And then the position that you're writing in. You know, you're representing yourself in pro per. So you just take block lettering and write it in. You're going to write in here what you're doing. So what are you doing? You're doing an answer with attachments. A through C, let's say. You know, exhibits, whatever you're going to put in. And then as you've eliminated the comes now, you're going to change it to comes now John Doe. Of course, you're not going to use capital letters. Or what you can do is just take the printer and run a blank piece of page through and, you know, stick your word up there. And in Word, you just type in all the stuff and you print it through on a piece of paper. So when you hold the piece of paper over this piece of paper, you can tell it's going to print in the correct area. And then you take the scanned one that's blank and feed it in and use the printer to print off all the stuff you're going to do. You can hand write in and it's admissible in court. So you don't necessarily have to do it in print with a printer. Then you take their allegations and in this case, you know, plaintiff, number one, plaintiff is now and was all times mentioned herein, either a corporation, a partnership, a sole proprietor, or other legal entity in good standing, and is the rightful plaintiff authorized to collect the debt which is subject to this action. Are you going to admit that, deny that, or have no knowledge? Well, I don't have any knowledge if the plaintiff is a corporation, and if it's rightful to collect the debt. So I just put, I have no knowledge. And you've just answered it. The next one is, plaintiff is informed and believes, and on the basis alleges that at least one defendant is an individual who resides in the state of California. Well, I don't know if the bank knows that or not. How would I know? So I'm going to put, I have no knowledge. So you see how you go through. You just go through the list and answer it one thing at a time, and then go make three copies, send one off to these guys up here with a proof of service, and send them a copy of the proof of service, and then take your original proof of service and your original wet ink signed answer and go down to the court, and along with another copy of it. And then the court will take your originals and enter it into the file folder for your case, and you can get your copy file stamped.
Hey, Angela.
Yeah.
Could I maybe pick a topic real quick? Just wanted to get some feedback from other people. It was on this show a couple months ago that I had someone had told me about Rod Class.
Yeah.
And him for the past. I just wanted to kind of some of the things that he's doing are really interesting, especially since he got that ruling about the police departments and the all capital letter courts being private entities.
Oh yes, Patricia was talking about it earlier.
Oh yeah.
Go ahead.
But so basically, the defense is that since they're private entities, they're completely foreign to all of us, and basically, anytime you know, go into court for a traffic ticket, you challenge a jurisdiction because by the statutes in the U.S. Code and under the they're supposed to go to the State Department and enter paperwork and have the State Department notify us that they want to take us to court. Because that's apparently the proper procedure between two foreign entities. And then also what about how the 11th Amendment takes all the judicial power away from the courts. And that, I mean, that might be a hard argument there, but I mean, to hear him say it, it sounds perfect. And he said that it takes away from the prosecutor too, because their position was granted under the Judiciary Act, and that's the same act that gave the judges their status. I was just wondering if anybody else had.
Yeah, that's covered in Rod's Coram Nobis. Everything you just said.
Yep. I've been going over that document for about the past week because I'm getting ready to try to use it.
I'm going to put it into my case as well, or cases, a couple of cases, right, along with an affidavit. So I'm gearing up myself. But, yeah, excellent. I want to keep them on their toes. Actually, I put it in a criminal case of mine, and they ran right over it, but that case is on appeal, and I'm trying to find, I mean, I didn't know as much as I do know now, so I'm trying to point back, go back in time, you know, on that issue.
Right.
Because on appeals, they're talking procedure, well, guess what? It made it in, and you guys ran over me, and I raised the issue, so we'll see.
I've got some recent experience with that as of last Friday.
Really?
I was in court on my fourth continuance for my traffic stop. And this time, I submitted the case from the North Carolina Division of Administrative Hearing.
Cool.
And they put that on ignore. I said, well, that's okay. I just needed it on the record.
Exactly.
And so this time when I went in, I had the no judicial powers, 11th Amendment notice, 11th Amendment violation, and demand for administrative hearing against the plaintiff.
There you go.
And so when I went in, and I did this the time before, and the new young whippersnapper prosecutor laughed. The older one didn't say anything. But when I went in, I went into the court, and I said, I'm commencing a court of record on the commons, not to be confused with the United States Incorporated Public. Under the law of common man and natural law and or law of nations, all definitions and words taken are will be taken from the 1828 Webster's Dictionary unless I state otherwise. I'm giving special appearance as grantor, general executor, and or beneficiary for the all caps life trust called in my name in all caps and or any derivation thereof, and in no capacity either as trustee or administrator for the said life trust. all other assumptions, presumptions by the court or prosecution, or attempt by the court to change the law form through what may appear as direct or casual statements or questions or trickery on the record of the commons will be a nullity ab initio and an example of other than good behavior. The court may commence. I acknowledge all employees of this court oath of office, and I offer my immunity as long as they operate in good behavior. The state of Florida will take judicial notice of, and then I read the I read the no judicial powers and 11th Amendment, and I stopped at where he goes when he gets to option A. Is that, you know, that was the meat and taters.
Yeah.
And I got to that, and I said, and of course, you know, the judge denied my motion to dismiss. Again, I said, well, that's okay. I said, I just need it on the record so when I move this up the chain.
Exactly.
You understand that, right? And she goes, now, it's the little things I pay attention to. She goes, yes, sir, I do. And I said, oh, by the way, I said, what law firm do you presume to be under today? And she said, well, statutory. I said, really? Well, could you tell me where I could locate the rules of procedure for statutory law?
There ain't none.
Because there aren't any.
And right.
Then she, went, oh, then she said, oh, criminal. I said, well, which is it? Statutory or criminal law? And if I'd been a little faster on my feet, I would have gone, okay, criminal, so where's the injured party? I mean, other than me.
Exactly.
And, but I didn't. I'm like I said, I just wanted it on the record.
Well, the other
and so once I finished with that, I said, well, that's all I got. My tribunal's closed. I hand the court back to you, Judge. And she said, thank you. And she wasn't being a smart ass.
Right.
And this time, Mr. Prosecutor didn't giggle so much.
Well, you could also invoke, you know, just say, I'm invoking, you know, 1776, you know, law form today. I mean, you can have fun with these guys.
Well, the other thing you could have done, was when she said it was criminal, where does the criminal court get jurisdiction? Oh, that's under Title 50 of the United States Code.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Okay.
That'll probably tighten some sphincter muscles in the courtroom.
Under the civil procedures, what is it, Rule 4? Or not Rule 4, but Rule 2? All cases come under civil? There's no such statement for criminal.
One
where
action.
Where did the criminal come from? It comes from Title 50 of the United States Code. And then it comes against enemy, alien, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I forget what the full term is. Enemy, alien, resident, okay? So if you're not an enemy, alien, resident, they can't bring a criminal charge against you.
Very good.
All right, so that's the other thing that Rod points out. In fact,
yeah.
It's about, I don't know how many recordings back, he goes through the whole shemale, asking him what jurisdiction are they in. If they say they're in law, oh, then, you know, when he says, is this a constitutional court? They said, yes. Oh, then you're coming under title, under the Constitution, under the 11th Amendment, you have no jurisdiction in law, equity, or controversies. Oh, no, it's under administrative. Oh, I'm glad you brought that on, because if it's administrative, only I could be the prosecutor in here, and why is that guy standing over there, pointing to the prosecutor, right?
Okay. Only you can be the plaintiff in an administrative matter.
That's right. Then, oh, it's not administrative, okay? Well, they come back with another law form, then you hit them with another one, under the Foreign Sovereign Immunity. You don't belong in his court. Okay? So no matter how you do it. Now, the other thing we're missing here, when you're talking the quorum nobis, you need to find the notice with the 15 issues in it. That is the one where it explains the quorum nobis. All right? And as a result of Rod coming up with the additional material that he's come up with, that 15 is probably going to turn into 20. And the quorum nobis is going to have to be expanded, right?
Is it 15? I thought it was 10 issues. Are you talking about Rod's document?
Yes, that's the old unit. Go to rodclass.com and look for the 15 issues.
Okay.
Right?
Go with the one that has the largest number, because that's the latest.
Yeah, the 15 issues so far is the latest one. And also you'll have to get the quorum novus that goes along with those 15 issues, right? Because you may have, you don't know which quorum novus you got, right?
Right.
So then what you have to do is get the court to take notice of that. And then when the judge starts going against you, you got to bring up the rules and the laws that the judge is breaking. He's not allowing you due process. He's breaking a particular Title 18 law, okay?
Or if he's trying to rush you to judgment, that's another one.
That's another one, okay? So you have to know the laws they're breaking in Title 18 also. And Rod's covered these on his various conversations he's had in his deal. So you're going to have to go back and listen to a whole bunch of calls.
Right, I've been listening to them. I've just been going backwards.
That's right. That's what you have to do.
Rod really knows how to put it down.
What's that website?
Rodclass.com.
Thank you.
Now, in addition to that, there's links to other sites, such as the Private Attorney General site and several others that have got his material on it. Okay? But they're trying to consolidate and get all the material on one site.
One other thing, and I'll get off of here. After I asked for a continuance in the little dude prosecutor before I closed my court, he said, Judge, we've already given four. We're not going to give him another one. And so she said, well, you know, since we're not going to put you in jail, we're not going to give you a trial by jury, which is what I demanded.
Yep.
And so I'm like, I'm standing there listening.
She said it was a criminal charge.
Right. But she says, we're going to have just a judge's bench on Wednesday. And I said, well, then I need a continuance to prepare for that. And the guy goes, he's already had four. We're not giving him a fifth one. Then she said, well, then we'll see you on Wednesday. I said, I don't consent to that. And she just stopped.
She just stopped
and went, well, I think, you know, since you were expecting a jury trial and, you know, we kind of flipped this on you at the last second, I'll give you your continuance. Will the 23rd of January be okay? I said, yeah, that'd be adequate.
That's awesome.
Because what I did, Angela, the guy you had on last week?
Yeah.
Glenn?
You put the paperwork in, didn't you?
Yeah, that's why I needed 30 days. So I can cure the default.
Yeah, there you go. There you
so
go.
I came home, got that paperwork together. Drove over to the, you know, I didn't notarize that I had two other witnesses, including myself, which has more power than the notary, and because they're real people. And I took it over to the state attorney's office and had them sign all three copies. And then I went back over to the court and had them stamp their, you know, I gave them a copy for the file and had them stamp my copy. So I've got all that covered. Now I'm just waiting for the 10 days and send the, you know, the default with opportunity to cure. That's 3 days. And then after that, the final. And then it's the writ of precipice to the clerk. And when the clerk defaults, I go after the judge with a writ of mandamus ordering the clerk to do her job. And then after that, I've got a judicial complaint just sitting on the burner.
Cool.
That's awesome. By the way, let me mention this before we go any further. None of this is meant to be legal advice. It's just sharing what our experiences are as we proceed through the myriad of bullshit we got to go through to be left alone in this country at the present time.
Okay, Morris. If you, any of you got any questions, go ahead and raise your hand. We're going to be coming out in the future with some packages, and these are going to be do-it-yourself package, how you can remove summons, how you can rescind all contracts, rescind your Social Security number, all of that good stuff, your credit repair stuff, loan elimination, foreclosure elimination, traffic ticket elimination, IRS elimination, all of it. We're going to come out with these packages, and when we do, we'll
These are do-it-yourself packages. We'll make everybody aware and put the information up so that you can get it. If you have questions or comments, you'll have access to us. We'll also stand behind these packages and guide you and walk you through it until you get it done right. And it's just another effort on our part to make sure that you succeed at what you're doing. Okay? So y'all hold on a moment. We're going on.
One thing to be clear on is that when you put your facts into the record in the complaint or counterclaim, you must list them individually, or the opposition can deny your whole statement if only one statement is contained. In other words, if you're going to make one long treatise that's 3 pages long, if there's one item in there that they don't agree with and they deny, they can just say, "I deny," for the whole thing. So we're going to use an example of how it should look. You have the judicial cognizance, which is the court takes notice of the following. And what I'm pointing out is here, you have line one. You just make simple statements. This constitutional court takes judicial cognizance and decrees as follows. 2, judicial cognizance. 3, 4, 5. So you make single statements of, on such and such a date, I received a letter from the bank stating that there was a debt owed to them of so much money. See, that's a fact. And then when they have to answer that or lose. And the answer would be, I admit, I deny, or I have no knowledge. So if they say, I admit that we sent you a letter on that time. Well, of course they're going to admit it because you got a copy of it, and they're going to be liars if they don't. You understand? So you have to individually notate your points, because that way when they do an answer, you're going to use their answer against them, right? So it should be in the form of a noun verb subject, i.e., 1, on or about June 4th, 2010, alleged Officer Dandy issued a citation for speeding to John Doe in all capital letters. 2, on or about July 16th, the Superior Court of Wonderland sent a notice to appear, re-citation number blah, 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 to John Doe in all capital letters. Now, you know, each item is going to list individually so that the opposition has a chance to address each individual item, and that's how you're going to get information to use against them from their own statement, which is going to be in the form of an answer. If they fail to answer it, they lose. The next thing to do in statutory law court is to file any motions. Motions are a plea to the court to move the court. The court sits there like a feather on an ocean, and it doesn't do anything until somebody asks it to, allegedly. Okay. So when the DA puts in a complaint, then that's when the court can do something. So motions are, you are going to try to move the court to act and to judge whether their suit should be dismissed, should be stricken, should be adjusted or changed, etc. Since this isn't actually a court and it's an arena with players rather than the judge, it's a common misconception that the judge is the court. The true definition of the court is, court, an agency of the sovereign created by it directly or indirectly under its authority consisting of one or more officers, and we read that earlier. You could file a motion to dismiss, right to a speedy trial, let's say, if they have violated the code and they are bound to honor it. That states if they haven't started the trial within 30 days following the arraignment or the arrest, the case be dismissed. So you would put the evidence into your motion showing a summary, the facts, the law, and the conclusion. Summary, the facts, the law that supports your right to get the decision you want, and then your conclusion of law. A motion can be filed to avoid filing an answer, which is quite common because, let's put it this way, he who's right wins in court. The truth is what wins. Lies and deceit don't win. So if you have a winning case, and you know most of the time you will if you know what you're doing, I mean, unless you're a bad person and have actually trespassed upon somebody else's rights, you're going to win. So what's the other side going to try to do? Keep your evidence out. A motion can be filed to avoid filing the answer. So what's the first thing they're going to want to do? Not put any evidence into the file where they could be found guilty of fraud and sent to prison. So they're going to try to avoid answering it, whether it's true. You know, the answer is I admit, I deny, or I have no knowledge. So if they have to admit to things, they're not going to like that. And if they say they deny it and you prove that they were guilty before, they're in trouble. So they're going to file a motion. The opposition will be keen on dismissing your suit and not answering the points you have presented and be bound by their statement. So they will immediately issue a motion to strike or motion to dismiss and hope their good buddy and co-conspirator in crime, i.e. the judge, will squash you and your rights like a bug and protect them from having to be responsible and answer the charges against them. When they put a motion into the record, they will have to mail you a copy, and you will have 21 days to write a reply to their motion and have it heard at a motion hearing. You will call your document, quote, opposition to motion to strike or opposition to motion to dismiss or whatever their motion is. In it, you will start off the same. Comes now John Doe, one of the people of the Republic of California, in this court of record to oppose the motion to strike, to wit. 1. Chase Manhattan has no jurisdiction nor authority to issue a motion as they have not proven any standing to appear or speak. In other words, if you don't have the right to speak, you don't have standing, then you can't present anything. You can't be heard. First, you have to demonstrate that there's some kind of loss that you're claiming, and have not presented a proper claim upon which relief can be granted. 2. The attorneys Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe, who entered the motion, have not shown any evidence of a power of attorney to represent the alleged plaintiff, Chase Manhattan Bank. 3. The attorneys have not demonstrated any license to practice law issued by the state of California to represent a legal entity. Now, you notice I could have put those two in the same number, right? But I want them to have to answer each individual position I'm making. So you can use issues that are defective in, and also the case law they cite is always worth looking up at Find Law or Google to see what the case is about. In other words, if they put a motion to strike in and they cite some court cases, most of the time they're bogus. I mean, they may be real court cases, but the things that they're talking about, the issues they're talking about in those court cases, don't apply to you. So it's a good idea to read those court cases and bring up the fact that that court case doesn't apply to your case. Don't make this a huge effort, as no judge will read a long paper and doesn't care about you anyway. You only have to present the issues and object to the motion. That's all. I don't expect the judges to be anything but corrupt when they are ruling against the people in favor of their paycheck. I mean the state and their true masters, the bankers, who are supplying the paycheck. Now and then you will find an honest judge, God bless him, who believes in equity and fairness. He will still have a hard time seeing the truth that there is no money and will not believe the bankers are violating the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Sections 8 and 10, and that there really is no authority to create money or credit from thin air. When the magistrate rules against you, you can vacate his ruling with a writ of error and order to show cause, which he will hate, as it is work, and he really has no legitimate reason for ruling against you. And he's not likely to put any reasons why, you know, you have to use points and authorities which are previous evidences of the law. Supply court case sites, you know, Supreme Court case sites are great, but local court case sites will work. Opinions that are issued that support your right to do what you did. So you think the judge is going to supply you with research, all that? He's a busy guy. He's fleecing people right and left in court, and he doesn't have time to deal with your case. After you've challenged jurisdiction and they have failed to show proof of claim of having jurisdiction, you write a writ of prohibition to stop the inferior court from proceeding. How do you know it's an inferior court? If it's not operating according to the qualities of a court of record, proceeding according to the common law, a requirement in California Constitution under Article 6, Section 1, which I read to you previously, the writ of prohibition has to be filed prior to a trial and not after. So a writ of prohibition, how do you know if it's an inferior court? Well, if there's a court that's superior to it, it's inferior, right? Can an appellate court overrule the superior court in California? Sure. Can the Supreme Court overrule the appellate court? Sure. Does that make the appellate court and the superior court inferior courts by definition? Sure. Why is a common law court, a court of record, the highest court in the land? Because when a jury makes a decision, it can't be overturned even by the Supreme Court of the United States. Read the Seventh Amendment. The Seventh Amendment states, no jury decision can be overturned by any court in the land. So a court of record is one where the jury makes the determination and proceeds according to common law. And the judge can't make any rulings or determinations in a court of record. So when you go to court in the Superior Court and the judge starts making rulings and determinations and overthrowing and throwing out your counterclaim or your claim, he's acting unlawfully. He has no authority to do that. At the end, put without prejudice by John Doe and send a copy of it off to proof of service to the opposition, that's to the lawyer for Chase Manhattan, or to the DA, and take the original wet ink proof of service and the original answer in wet ink to the court and bring a copy to get file stamped for your records as evidence you can use later in a complaint evidencing the bad behavior of the judge to the boss of the court personnel, i.e. judicial performance or the judicial counsel. The next thing to be aware of and should be done right at the beginning of having a case is that you have the right to discovery. This is really powerful stuff. To be able to find evidence that vindicates you and or cements your right to win. There are different ways of getting evidence. The first of which is anything in the public record is automatically admissible as evidence. The banks love this as the deed of trust is admissible without having anyone have to testify to the truth of it. See how deceptive that is? Hey, we went to the recorder's office and we got this deed of trust and the deed of trust says you owe us all this money and you can't question the deed of trust. The deed of trust doesn't have to testify. The person who made the deed of trust doesn't have to testify. The fact that it was recorded in the public record makes it true. Oh, wow. So if I go down to the court of record and file a statement that the bank president is guilty of fraud, that makes it true just because I filed it? No. They're going to come after you for filing a fraudulent document, number one. Number two, your county recorder will never allow you to put things into the record and file things at the county recorder's office because they know how important they are. They are the gatekeepers of slavery. That's their job. To be the gatekeepers of slavery, the right to enslave you by keeping the public record only available to the slave masters. The minute you try to record anything, you get a bunch of lip about it. Put a lie into the record and no one can be sent to jail as there's no guilty party, only a dead corporate fiction. So when the corporation signs something saying that you owe money, can you actually send Bank of America to jail? It's a legal fiction. Bank of America, a piece of paper, a legal document. What, are you going to put the legal document in a jail cell? That wouldn't have much effect, would it? But you put the CEO of Bank of America in a legal jail cell, and you'll see you get a lot of action out of that. If you put a lie into the county recorder's office, that's a felony. But they do it. It's, oh, well, you can't discover it because we, the court, will block you. You still have the right, however, to due process, which includes discovery, and there's no better tool than a subpoena duces tecum, or an order from the court to comply with bringing the requested body, in other words, you're going to have the CEO of the bank, the body and the paperwork, or just the paperwork, to the court to be entered into the record at trial. You can subpoena the bank chief financial officer if you have sent him administrative remedy debt validation letters and he hasn't replied. Now he is a party to the case, and he can be forced to testify. I mean, you're going to ask him, did you receive these letters? He's going to say, no. And you're going to say, well, I mailed them to you, care of the Bank of America. Are you saying that somebody at the Bank of America committed mail fraud and took your mail and opened it by mistake? And you can ask him relative questions. He won't want to answer. So you can subpoena the original promissory note and the deed of trust to to be brought by the bank president and testified to. You can subpoena the attorney general to testify to the constitutionality of the penal code or vehicle code that you're being charged with. You can require the other side to do a deposition, that's a sworn statement that's notarized, and answer your predetermined list of questions, or swear their answer in front of a notary.
Okay, Moses. Now, this is quite a few tricks and stuff that you can do. And what I want to recommend is that you all listen to this broadcast over and over and over and glean this information. But the it's very important for us to understand this. And it's just like anything else that we've ever learned. It just so happened that law was kept out of the school system. We should have learned it a long time ago. But there's no reason in the world why we can't learn it now. And especially with what we've heard here tonight and what they got going on down there. We need some kind of defense. And so when you learn the rules, learn how to play, and stay on top of it, because they've been doing it so long, they done got relaxed with what they're doing. And you could just go ahead and challenge them and make sure you do it right. And the way to do it right is to learn it right. Okay? And I just wanted to bring that little point out. We've come to the end of the broadcast, and I hope you all have gotten something out of tonight's broadcast. And we're going to be coming back in the future with part two. And so y'all make sure that you all keep your eyes open. If you are on your social sites, I've been banned from Facebook again for 30 more days from befriending my people. So I need you all to send me a friend request to Tahaka Amana L. Bay on Facebook, and I'll go ahead and grant that, and we keep on going, and we won't worry about them, okay? And once again, I appreciate you all for listening in, and we're going to go ahead and close out the broadcast. You all have a good evening.